Welcome, everyone. Let's call the meeting of the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee to order on this Monday, April 11th. Members, we're going to ask Ms. Barr to note the roll as you come in. And we do have, do we have minutes? Minutes of the last meeting. The chair will entertain a motion for someone who's looked those over for the April 5th minutes.
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Representative Vogel moves the minutes. Further consideration or discussion? Hearing none, members, let's vote. All those in favor signify by aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you. The minutes are adopted. Appreciate that. Today we're going to hear a few bills, and hopefully we can cruise right on through them. But we do want to take time, make sure we have the dwell time we need to discuss and vet some of these issues. But while you're thinking about how far to discuss, I just want to set a couple of ground rules here. Okay. Members and members of the audience, the first bill up is House File 615 by Representative Biskins, dealing with driver ed requirements. The next one, House File 867 by Representative Bruce Anderson, about driving instruction permit modifications. Those bills will be heard today. We'll take no action. It is possible we'll take action on Wednesday. We'll bring them back, discuss them some more, and vote on them if the chair decides that he wants to include them in his omnibus bill. But at this moment, we're going to hear them sort of like an informational hearing. So we will ask for Representative Biskins. We have to move the bill to get in front of the committee. You're a member of the committee, Representative Biskins, if you'd like to move it. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 615 to be before the committee and hopefully at some point be sent to the consent calendar.
Okay, that won't be our action today, but it is in front of the committee for discussion purposes. Nice try. Thank you, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You, Representative Simon, would like to proceed with your bill. Please
thank
do.
You, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to begin by offering an oral amendment to the bill so that it lines up with the language currently in the Senate file.
There is a Senate file. Mr. Burris, are you ready to copy? Mr. Representative Biskins, proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, on page 1, line 16, strike home hyphen classroom and insert home school. On page 1, line 19, strike home school and insert home school. In other words, Mr. Chairman, strike the one word homeschool and insert two words homeschool.
Is that the extent of your oral amendment?
And there's one other, Mr. Chair. On page 2, line 1, strike the words or has completed. And, Mr. Chairman, that would get the bill in the shape the author would like to present it.
Mr. Burris, do you need to read that back to us? Do you have that?
Mr. Chair, members, if I could have just a couple seconds here.
All right. While Mr. Burris is taking a moment to make that official, I'm going to hold up my pager here and ask that you set all your phasers to stun, please. Today, anybody who, if I hear a ringing phone, you will be required to bring treats to the next meeting, so please set your phones to vibrate, silence, or something like that. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get some clarity on the Biskin-Simon-Houseman bill's fate, which is there was a motion to have it before the committee, but is it your intention that when we take action it would be included in an omnibus bill or travel separately?
Representative Hornstein, thank you. Oh, man.
I'm just a member of the guy.
Turn your nameplate so I can see it a little better there. Oh, boy. That was a little brain cramp. If and when we pass this bill, it has to go to public safety. They want to see it next. So we will not pass it today. There's a good chance we could pass it on Wednesday, however.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the clarification. Mm-hmm. further questions or comments for the good of the body? Mr. Burris, ready to go? Okay. Mr. Burris has the amendment, and we'll just assume that you're incorporating that for the get the bill in the shape you want to discuss. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. With almost three decades under my belt as a professional educator, one line sticks out to me more than any other that I've learned in the almost 30 years, and that is there is nothing more unequal than to treat unequals as equals. And I've tried as a classroom teacher to live by that mantra, and what that means to me is that students learn in different ways. They learn in all kinds of different ways, and the thing that is probably the greatest disservice we can do to a child is to try and fit 30 different shaped pegs through the same square hole, and I think that is quite inappropriate. What we need to do as educators is we need to continue to branch out and try different modalities, learn different modalities, use different modalities so as to give the highest possible learning experience to each individual child based on their learning styles and needs. What this bill has before you is to allow students to take the classroom portion of the driver's ed experience via online learning. It is a simple common sense proposal, changes nothing about the exam that they must pass, it changes nothing about behind the wheel, changes nothing about the experiential portion of their driver's said class. It simply allows them to take the course online. I had the distinct pleasure, members, of working with then Senator Steve Kelly in drafting and bringing into law in the state of Minnesota the language which allowed us to utilize online learning in our K-12 public school system. For a lot of students, that has been a wonderful experience and growth in the way we allow education to take place, and it's my pleasure to bring this proposal to you today. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have to my far right Representative Steve Simon, who has been the chief author of this bill in the past, and Mr. Chair, if it pleases you and the committee, I'd like to have him say a few words.
Representative Simon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I really appreciate that, and thank you to Representative Biskins for being gracious enough to allow me to say a few words. I have carried this bill in the past. I'm happy to hand the baton off to Representative Biskins. Members, this bill is bipartisan. It has been in the past. We were just short a couple of years ago, and then 3 years ago as well. Hopefully we can make some more progress this year and get it enacted into law. This really is about allowing just one other option on the menu for how kids can get their driver's permit. That's it. It's not a mandate on everyone, on anyone. Right now, as you know, in Minnesota, there are basically two options. A 15-year-old can take driver's ed at school, or he or she can take it at a private kind of driving academy. I took mine at AAA in St. Louis Park, for example, because I didn't want to, you know, waste an elective in class on driver's ed, so that was my choice and my family's choice. This would just add a third element, which is a online course that has to be approved by the Department of Public Safety. So this isn't any fly-by-night operation. This would have to be approved by people whose job it is to make sure we minimize and reduce traffic deaths. So it would have to be approved by them. They're the gatekeepers. And all it says is that you have the option in Minnesota, as about a third of the states in the country, including some big ones like California and Texas, already have, and simply gives kids and their families an option to have an online component. Again, screened and blessed by the Department of Public Safety, who isn't going to do it if it's some weirdo operation flying in from another state. It's got to meet certain specifications, and it's got to be safe. And remember, I say that you know, the real backstop here is the test. No kid in Minnesota is going to get his or her driver's permit unless they pass that multiple choice test, which we all had to do. And so even if, theoretically, any driver's permit instruction is really, really bad and really, really shoddy, well, the backstop is the test. So that goes for any mode of instruction here, whether it's a really bad or shoddy classroom experience or really bad or shoddy private driving academy experience. Hopefully those are few and far between, but if that were to be the case and a kid just bombed, didn't get the material, somehow it wasn't getting through to this kid, then he or she presumably would not pass that test. And keep in mind, this is only for the book learning. This is not for, obviously, behind the wheel. No one is asserting at all that you can substitute an online experience for behind the wheel. This is only the training for the multiple choice permit test, which you can take at age 15 in Minnesota. When I had this bill before, I couldn't find it for this hearing. I used to pass out a prop, which is very interesting. Representative Hausman, I see, is here. She's been a great supporter of this bill. And unfortunately, I couldn't locate it in time for the hearing. But you almost can't make this stuff up. In Minnesota, St. Cloud State University advertises a course where you can learn how to become a driving instructor. And that course is an online course. So at Minsky right now, we teach the people who are teaching the kids online. So that's somehow okay. And yet, up until now, we've resisted the idea that the kids themselves can learn online. And keep in mind, this is a choice for families to make. They need not take it. And I think you're going to hear a lot of arguments, some sound, legitimate arguments. I may disagree, but they're legitimate arguments about why this is a bad idea. All of those arguments, though, I would say, are great arguments for why a family or a kid would choose not to take the online option. They are not good arguments, in my opinion, for why that shouldn't be an option in the first place. So when you hear, as you will, all the reasons why online is not the superior mode of teaching this stuff, keep in mind, those are great arguments for why Mr. and Mrs. Minnesota might choose not to send their kid to the online. You might want to say in your family or other families that, you know, I really want a real human being teaching my kid the difference between a white line and a yellow line. I'm not going to go in for this online business. And that's fine. Those are great arguments in that context, but not such great arguments for why they shouldn't even be on the menu. So I would just leave you with that, members, and thanks a lot to Representative Biskins, and I hope you'll give it some fair consideration. Thanks.
Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony and for bringing the bill forward. Before we go to testifiers, members, are there questions for either Representative Simon or Biskins? Seeing none, let's take a few moments and have testimony. There are folks who would like to testify for and against the bill. As I call you forward, would you bear in mind that we, if you could be as concise as possible and state your name for the record and whether you're testifying for or against the bill. And Gary, I won't even try your last name. And are you Debbie Prudholm? Are you Debbie?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. One of you please proceed. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Ziffern. I'm the founder and COO of DriversEd.com. I've had the pleasure of testifying here before. Thank you also to the presenters, to the authors of the bill. It's hard to add to their eloquent advocacy here, but I'm going to try anyway. So as you can see here, and as the representatives emphasized, this is simply adding an option for Minnesota families. And it's exclusively an option for the classroom piece, not the behind-the-wheel piece. So one result that we've seen in other states where online driver's education is approved and licensed is that it frees up licensed driving instructors to really focus on behind the wheel. Oftentimes, a problem that driving instructors have is scheduling. So if you'll have 30, and in some cases more than 30 students, all completing the driver's education portion at the same time, it becomes a real challenge to fit their dedicated, required behind the wheel time. One of the real advantages for having an online option is that students take their online driver education classroom piece on their own time, and so they complete it in a staggered way, which then allows licensed driving instructors to concentrate on behind-the-wheel skill building, which is really, to my mind, where the real emphasis needs to be for public safety. Now there are the studies. Minnesota's own Department of Public Safety concluded in 2009 that there is no strong evidence whether or not, that there's no evidence that online students taking an online course fared any worse or better on exit exams than did those taking traditional classroom courses. There are a handful of such studies. Most importantly here, I'd like to point to a NHTSA study, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. In their most recent study of novice teen driver education and training, here you have for the first time the national organization recognizing alternative delivery modalities. And we can make all of these studies available for you if you like. And this echoed a 2003 study. You know, we're nearly a decade ago, which is the first time this was looked at seriously by the California Department of Motor Vehicles, which unsurprisingly found the same thing to be true. Now, there are other studies than just this, but and please, we can provide you with these studies if you'd like to see them. So, speaking a little bit about driversed.com, we have taken the time to have our curricula reviewed and ultimately approved by the Driving School Association of the Americas and the Road Safety Educators Association. Now, these two organizations would not, you know, they weren't the most enthusiastic about online modalities, but they have given us their blessing because of the quality of our courses. We are licensed in 13 states. You'll notice here that I also listed Minnesota because we are approved and have been for a long time to provide a book course, a booklet that we send as a correspondence course to homeschooled students. And that is the only such case of all of these lists of states that you can see here. As Representative Simon pointed out, some of these states are really large populations, California, Texas, Florida. So we can offer our course now to roughly 120 million Americans, nearly half the country. When you take into consideration that only 26 states have a formal driver education requirement and that we're licensed in 12 to provide them online, that we're nearly half have adopted it. We see the adoption rate moving very, very quickly. This is an example of the driversed.com homepage. I invite everyone to visit it if you like. We're also the providers of online driver's education for the Texas Virtual School, the Florida Virtual School, Region 4 Educational Service Center, the Central Indiana Educational Service Center, Houston Independent School District, dozens of charter schools and homeschool organizations. In other words, what I'm trying to show is there's nothing really new about online driver's education and nothing really untested. It may seem new in Minnesota, but it's really we've been serving students in the U.S. since 2004. And the course should not be mistaken for a book that's online. This is not a pamphlet or Department of Public Safety or Motor Vehicles highway manual that just happens to be read online. Our courses are just that. They are robust, interactive courses that involve animation, online movies, importantly, punctuated assessments. In other words, students cannot advance from one section to another without first being tested on their knowledge, on what they've learned. And that's one of, with the advance of technology, we can do a great many things that really speak to today's 15-year-olds and today's learners. Security is a question that often arises, and that, you know, how do you know that the person taking the course is the person who's registered for the course? And the first thing I would say to that is what we have not found are any extraordinary fraud. And I don't know if in Minnesota there is a particular problem with fraud. I doubt that would be the case. But we do in online courses is we erect obstacles to make cheating more expensive than doing the course yourself. As Representative Simon pointed out, the backstop is the test at the DPS. At the end of the day, the student needs to know the material. Importantly also are that parents are, in fact, responsible, right? The children are not paying for the courses online and often not registering themselves. And so the parents certainly participate in their children's progress through the course. But in addition to that, we put in security mechanisms, which I'm happy to talk about if there are questions after. In conclusion, I want to say this, that with allowing an online option, one is allowing those students who otherwise wouldn't be able to participate in formal driver education from simply aging out. Because once you reach 18, there are no formal driver education requirements. You take the test and you're done. So for those kids who are high-achieving students who play three varsity sports and simply could not fit a classroom course, whether it's offered at school or at a local driving academy, into their schedule, they would simply wait till they were 18 without having any driver education. For those kids who may not live in proximity to a driving school or whose public school no longer provides it, they would simply age out of driver education. You can see where I'm going with this. I can list lots of examples, but in the interest of time, I think you understand my point. So the ease of participation in online courses, being able to set your own schedule and participate in your own time, has the result of increasing participation in driver's education and contributes ultimately to public safety. Thank you.
Ms. Prudholm, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Beard. You know, I first want to say thank you to the committee and to you yourself and to the authors for giving driver education some attention. There's been a long drought of lack of attention to driver education. I also thank all my colleagues here today that have come to really support driver education, even though we may disagree on the methods. My name is Debbie Prudholm, and my husband Mark and I have owned a driving school for 15 years here in Minnesota, and during that time we've considered ourselves leaders. And in that 15 years, we've trained about 60,000 drivers, and I myself have trained 12,000 of them. So I've had a lot of extensive experience in the classroom especially. And then additionally, I'm involved at the highest levels in leadership on the national level with traffic safety education. And I was also involved in the project that Mr. Sifrin mentioned, the standards that NHTSA just published. And we, my husband and I, would not recommend any method of education or training that would adversely affect a novice teen driver. That just doesn't make any sense. As you know, this bill allows internet-based education for driver education. I was going to mention to Representative Simon that I hope I wasn't his teacher. That would really be showing my age. Just regarding this method, though, today here what we're talking about is we're talking about a method. And we're not talking specifically about how courses would be designed. That is still yet to be regulated by the Department of Public Safety. And as you've also heard, there are 13 states using this method, with over half of the teen population in the U.S. having the ability to access online learning for driver education. And even just a couple of days ago, the American Driver and Traffic Safety Education Association, ADSEA, which is the professional association for the public high school teachers, they've launched an online driver education classroom option for teens. And then we stress that this is an option. And I do trust that people know what is best for them in terms of what they choose. And finally, also, as you've heard, that instructor training and certification for driver ed instructors can be done and is regularly done on the internet. And then also just to restate that this doesn't change any of the prerequisites that are required: 6 hours of behind the wheel training and also parent education, which a lot of driving schools are doing. A lot of public high schools also are doing parent education, and I don't feel that this would change that. And then also remembering that anything that is utilized here in Minnesota would be approved by the Department of Public Safety, and that's really essential. I want to share with you why I support the method. I have the flexibility that it offers the learner, the consistency of delivery, and the accountability for content. I think that's a real big one. Learners for whom English is a second language can spend extra time if needed to learn concepts. Cost is affordable and also stabilized with rising gas prices. We may have a real serious problem in the cost of driver education. And then to really consider the students, who are the learners. Students today favor using interactive technology as part of the educational process. In terms of looking at the flexibility issues, individuals can access material when it's convenient for them, instead of having to be in a classroom at a certain time or a certain date.
Ms. Prudholm?
Yes.
Could I ask you to move to your conclusion? I'm trying to manage the clock here for people testifying both for and against the bill. And there's a couple more on the calendar yet as well. So
surely I can. Yes.
You're plowing ground that has been made in points that we're conversant with, so please.
Definitely. Just the consistency of the course content, that is a very important point. And as laws are changed, online curriculum can be readily updated, and we don't have to wait for textbook editing and publications. So I would just say that in conclusion that the most important thing is the student. And today's students want to use technology to learn. The traditional driver education population of 14 to 16-year-olds like interactive technology and use it in almost every aspect of their lives. And while online education still seems somewhat new to many adults, including myself, for young people it's very natural to participate in self-paced ways to learn. And students find it much more interesting and stimulating. And good instructional design is essential, and we will rely on the Department of Public Safety to ensure that Minnesota's high standards are met, and we just ask you to support this method of training.
Okay, Ms. Prudhomme, thank you for your testimony. Members, is there questions for either Ms. Prudhomme or Mr. Sifrin? Seeing none, I'll call Mrs. Puff. Is she here? You testify. Oh, here we are. And again, we've heard some of the arguments for Mrs. Puff, so if you've got some new information, I'd encourage you to share that. I see you have a PowerPoint, too, to zip through. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. And
please identify yourself for the people listening online as well. That'd be great. Speaking of online, we're online. So.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, representatives. I will try to be brief. The fact sheet that I provided to you corresponds with the presentation. So if I do not get through the full presentation today, you can refer to the fact sheet. I am Ellen Puff, and I am in support of this bill. Other regional states that now offer online classroom instruction include Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa. The reasons are student convenience, parent convenience, student access to information, which I think is critical in Minnesota as we have rural areas, and also it's incredibly affordable for the student and for the parent. I will be offering this course online at www.minnesotadriversed.com. It's a local perspective on driving. I grew up here. I am the company founder, and I'm a veteran Minnesota educator. We will work with the Minnesota chapter of MAD and to not only support student education, but to comply with the law. I am also working already with the Department of Public Safety, looking at curriculum, developing curriculum, and I already have a relationship with them. In 2009, February, the Minnesota Department of Public Safety did a report to the legislature. The two areas of concern they found were quality of instruction and security and fraud with respect to online classroom education with driver's ed. My company will ensure that those issues will not be a problem. How will we do that? I will offer Minnesota DPS-approved curriculum. We will monitor computer time. The student will not be able to do more than 3 hours per day. That's currently the rule and is in effect for commercial driving schools. They can't have more than three hours within a 24-hour period. Assessment-based, kids won't be able to move forward until they get 80%. Parental involvement, activities, oversight, written acknowledgement that their kid has completed the course. If the parents are paying for it, they should be involved. I want the parents to work with the kids and look at the answers and have some parental oversight. And also, as an educator, I think it's critical that there's student focus, so we will ensure that there's a level of interactivity. DPS report in 2009, again, found that students who took the driver's ed education scored as well as other kids on the end of a course exam. So the kids in the classroom did as well as the kids online, and that was the finding of the report. The second thing that I thought was interesting from the report, they said there is little research on the efficacy of driver's education in general, even with respect to traditional methods of instructional delivery. In Minnesota today, homeschooled kids can take DPS-approved tests and take online driver's educational quizzes. The fee is a range of $35 to $100. Other Minnesota students must attend a commercial school or a private school. Some examples are Safeway or Sears Driving School. The fee for 30 hours of instruction and 6 hours of behind the wheel ranges from $385 to $400. Now, I live in St. Paul. I taught in St. Paul for 6 years. St. Paul School District, through Community Ed, provides behind the wheel and classroom instruction. That goes for $320. I will offer additional hours of instruction if required by DPS. And actually, DPS in the report suggested that we might want to do that with online instruction. They said 10 hours or more might be something to consider. Other states have done that. So tacking on a few hours of online instruction, I'm willing to do. I have a toll-free number that will be in place so kids outside the metro area can call for questions. We have a tech support online to answer questions. And I will do behind-the-wheel referrals. So if a kid types in his zip code and lives in Bemidji, he can find a behind-the-wheel instructor in Bemidji. I will conduct monthly webinars with the Minnesota chapter of MAD, and I want to educate students. I have been at assemblies where MAD has been there with a speaker, and the speaker has been talking about their involvement in drunk driving and crashes. And the kids are incredibly focused on that. They're into it. And I think we can recreate that with a webinar, a monthly webinar. I will be a local. I'm here. I can answer any questions with DPS, and I'm happy to work with them. And I care about the safety because I live here, my family lives here, and I think any security or safety issues can be addressed. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone may have.
Thank you, Mrs. Puff. Members, are there questions for Mrs. Puff at this time? Well, thank you for making your case. I appreciate it. I'd like to call now Kathleen Ron and Mary Mooden, is it? Would like to testify. Madden, I'm sorry. Mary. If you folks would come down. And Kathleen, why don't you go first? Identify yourself for the folks listening online and at home.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And for the record, and then... Mary can go right behind you, please.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate very much being here. And I am Kathleen Roan. I own Right Way Driving School in Grand Rapids, northern Minnesota. But more importantly, I am the grandmother of a 15-year-old boy, the light of my life, who will be getting his driver's license in June. And before I start with my argument or my statement that I had planned, I do want to say this. Please do not think that passing the permit test is an indication of what is a successful driving program. That's the most important point that I can make to you today. The permit test is 40 questions. You are allowed to miss 8. But now on with what I had planned to say. Recently, Brian Carey, a Minnesota state trooper, obtained permission from the Minnesota State Patrol to use their $350,000 simulator to show Iron Range teens the dangers of texting while driving. Teens used their own cell phones to text while they drove the simulator. They had a 98% fatality rate. I was present for this presentation, and I spoke with the teens afterwards. And they all commented to me how different that simulator was from their computer or internet games that they play all the time. Now, I do not have a $350,000 simulator, but after teaching driver's ed for over 19 years, I do know that the only way to reduce teen fatalities is for teens to come to their own conclusion about what is acceptable risk when they're behind the wheel. Speed, distraction, inattention, driving while impaired, and not buckled up. That's what's killing our teens. Experts agree that student-to-student and student-to-teacher interaction is an integral phase of the learning process. I'm only going to give you 3 quotes. The Allstate Foundation conducted an extensive survey of teens 15 through 18, indicating that safe driving messages would have more impact if they came from or with a connection to people in their own schools or communities. In its own rulemaking regarding driver's education rules that were conducted 2002 to 2004, the Minnesota Department of Public Safety found that, quote, students under the age of 18 need the structure and interaction by attending class. And finally, Professor Fred Motella, Executive Director of the National Institute for Driving Behavior, stated, the classroom sessions must parallel the in-car sessions. There cannot be 2 separate programs. A separate online course would have little value in increasing the experience that students would get in the car. The classroom becomes an irreplaceable phase of the learning process. I have attended TZD, Toward Zero Deaths, for many years, representing the education part of the 4 E's to reduce fatalities on Minnesota roads. we've seen a big improvement. I think when I first started teaching driver's ed, there were about 600 fatalities each year. Now we're at 410. Towards zero death, what's acceptable? None. That's why it's called towards zero death. On the Iron Range, a lot of the reason why teens die is because of choices they make. They're not buckled up. They're ejected from the car in single vehicle rollovers. Alcohol use, higher on the Iron Range than in the metropolitan area. And so these are the things that we work hard, 30 hours in our classroom, to make the teens make responsible decisions. Passing the permit test, you know, realistically, if they fail it the first time, they can take it the next day and the next day and the next day until they pass. That is not my priority in my classroom. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Madden, please proceed. Identify yourself. Please proceed.
I'm Mary Madden with Range Drivers Training. Thank you for listening to me, each and every one of you. I have been teaching driver education for 35 years. I feel I make a difference because I influence that student. These are not just students. They're not a line on my books. They are my neighbors. I live in small communities. I service small communities on the Iron Range. When a fatality occurs, they are the parents of people I know, or excuse me, the sons and daughters of the people I know. I would like you to think that the state test has been set. It's a backstop. I would like to say, classroom and behind the wheel, prepare a student not to meet a minimum state requirement of the permit test or the road test, because the road test, as my examiners explained to me many times over, is that it only shows how good a student can drive for 20 minutes one time during one day. They might just have gotten lucky. I would like you to think that the classroom and the behind the wheel are not based on minimum standards. We strive at my company to do maximum standards. We want a 16-year-old to be ready to be your and my driving peer at the end of their 30 hours and 6 hours of behind the wheel. They are going to be expected to know as much as you and I know. The continuity between classroom and behind the wheel is imperative. So when we get them for those minimum 6 hours, if their parent does not purchase more hours or spend more time with them, even though it is required, that they can make good defensive driving choices. And if they come from another program, even right now, a homeschooler who comes to my program may have learned a SIPD defensive driving strategy. In my class, I prefer the Smith system. It's been around much longer. It's been here probably as long as I have been teaching classroom. And those are the strategies that we do for defensive decision making. We owe it to our students to be defensive driving strategies to be consistent between the classroom and behind the wheel, because that most effectively uses their time and it creates the ability to make them our driving peers better than if that continuity was not there. I am currently preparing a Minnesota licensed teacher for an instructor position, and I can't tell you when our follow-up discussions come how often he says, "You use the same terms. Every instructor uses the same term." And I said, "That's because it's that important." I believe we will create a disconnect if we do not have that consistency between classroom and behind the wheel. We will waste time in the behind the wheel portion trying to bring them up to speed to our terminology or things they did not learn if online goes through. because it will probably be impossible to know what that child comes through, because I can tell you I tailor make my classes to the area I teach. Orr and Cook have had many fatalities at railroad tracks. My emphasis is there. Local tailoring, continuity. I thank you very much. Questions?
Well, thank you, Ms. Madden and Mrs. Ron. Are there any questions for either the testifiers' members? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking of the teenage learner, and I'm trying, and maybe this is just general observation and not so much question, but I try to imagine where most often I would see a teenager falling asleep. Would it be sitting in the classroom with a voice at the front talking to them, or would it be when they're on their computer engaged in interactive work?
Ms. Madden?
I can speak personally that if a student sleeps in my class, they come to the next one. they don't get a second chance. And the reason is because if you fall asleep behind the wheel, it could be fatal. They could be sleeping during a time when they might hear that one thing that could save their life. So in my class, it's not tolerated. And I see when students... experience brings you to the point where you can see where students are disengaging. Time to change gears, time to switch it up. How are you reaching them? After 35 years, there's many tricks in the old pocket to pull out to keep them engaged.
Thank you. Further questions, members? Cindy Thenis and Chip Hasen. Thank you, ladies, for your testimonies. Appreciate it. And Cindy, I'm sorry if I mispronounced your last name.
Cindy Thines.
Thines, there you go. Thank you for correcting it for the record. If you'd proceed.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Cindy Thines. I am a driving school owner for 10 years now, and I'm also an officer of the Minnesota Driving School Association. And I'm just here today to speak on behalf of the Driving School Association. This is the third time this bill has come before the House and the Senate. So there's been many driving school owners that I've spoken to about this across the state of Minnesota. And this is something that brings competitors together. I mean, we have all said this just doesn't make any sense to offer something that would be easier for teens, something that isn't easily verified. And it's a grave concern for the driving school owners in this state. Now, I speak on behalf of the commercial driving school owners. In case there's any confusion, in Minnesota, you can be a commercial driving school owner, but also the public schools offer driver's education as well. So I'm speaking on behalf of commercial driving school owners. Our major concern is that the safety of teens is being compromised for convenience. Our challenge is to teach 14, 15, and 16-year-olds defensive driving. Generally, teens are easily distracted, and they tend to look for the easiest way out. After reviewing the various internet driver's education programs that are currently available, we have not seen a level of user verification that we have been comfortable with. In class, the majority of our time and focus is not on the permit test material because it's very easily understood and tested on. Our primary emphasis is on trying to connect with the individual student to affect the invincible teen attitude. These kids believe that whatever's going to happen is not going to happen to them. That's what we're trying to affect. We feel that if online is not the best practice, however, we do feel that if it was a teacher-led, something one-on-one, we might be willing to look at that differently. Proponents argue that online classes are more convenient. They're correct. I wouldn't argue with that. Sometimes safety requires inconvenience. In fact, completing a 30-hour program in less than 10 hours is even more convenient, as some of the online programs do. Texting while driving is also convenient. Driving home from the bar after having a few drinks is convenient. Wearing a seatbelt or strapping a 4-year-old into a booster seat is not convenient. But Minnesota has established that safety is more important than convenience. Parents spend many hours driving their teens to sports practice, music, band, play, dance lesson, numerous other activities, 10 trips in a child's lifetime to bring them to a professional driver's educator is hardly too much to require after bringing them to all these other optional events. It's also important to point out that online driver's education will not offer a cost savings to families. The teen package of 30 hours and 6 hours of behind the wheel, 3 hours classroom and 6 hours of behind the wheel, in the metro area is approximately $350 to $400. The internet-based classroom program represented here today costs $99. The 6 hours of behind the wheel would still cost $250 to $275, which brings a total to $350 to $400. In short, this is not about cost savings. I want to speak on behalf of the many driving schools in very small communities in Minnesota. The average commercial driving school teaches about 300 students a year. If 25% of their student base would choose an online program, the resulting loss of income would cause those schools to become economically inviable. At that point, the school will have to decide either to close or raise the cost of their program, including the behind the wheel, to make up for the loss. If the school decides to close, there would be no one to provide the behind the wheel that would be required even with the online course. The parent would be forced to drive further distances to be able to find a behind the wheel provider. Our question is, why are we doing this? The pass rate for the permit test is currently 93% in the state of Minnesota. Our teen crash statistics are better than the national averages. Accordingly, no one should view online driver's ed as a fix for something that is broken. We don't believe that the system is broken here in Minnesota. In addition, this bill does have a fiscal note. It's going to cost money, taxpayer money. In today's political environment, spending tax dollars unnecessarily should be a concern. It's not just the driving school industry that, or Education Minnesota, that's arguing against this bill. We have many interested third parties as well. Minnesota Police Chiefs, the Sheriff's Association, the Trucking Association, the Minnesota Insurance Federation, to name a few. All these have come forward in the past and have said this doesn't make any sense for Minnesota teens. Here in Minnesota, we take teen driving very seriously. The graduated driver's licensing program has been carefully structured. We do not feel a change toward a loosely supervised classroom is in the best interest of our teens. At this time, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nines. Members, any questions? Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are teens in Minnesota that much different than, like, teens in California and some of these other states?
There is a difference in that the teens can be very similar, obviously, from one end of the country to the next. What's different is if you're looking at the comparison of the rates for the online that we've been speaking about here, what they're looking at is test rates. And again, test rates are not something that can be compared. If you're looking at test rates, I want you to look at crash rates. Minnesota has excellent numbers when you compare the crash rates from state to state. If you're just looking at permit test rates, you can take the permit test over and over and over again until you get it right.
Ms. Paula?
Yes. Do you know of any children that have ever taken the online test?
It's not legal here in Minnesota, so we don't have children here in Minnesota that's able to take it online.
A follow-up, Chairman?
Yes. My two children tested online in California.
California.
They're no different. They did. It's a wonderful online course. The beauty of online learning is that when it comes to simulation or terminology and things like that, you can always change that to match what the current classroom training is. That's the beauty of online. And what I'm worried about, and my kids have done great with this, and I think that's what we're talking about here is providing an option. We don't really know, I don't think, how many kids are going to do that here in the state if it gets approved. Mm-hmm. But I know as a parent, we could never get the kids to this Saturday school because both of us were working at the time, parents, and so this was a great option. And I think we've got people like that in Minnesota. We have a lot of students which are homeschooled, and maybe the parents have a problem getting the children. It's another option that we could possibly provide parents and students. Now, has that been talked about
Absolutely. We've talked a lot about it. We've actually looked at the program that's out in California. We've spoken to the driving schools in California. We have not had the experience of having children go through the program. I think that the specific point that you're making is that your children are excellent drivers, and I'm very pleased to hear that. A lot of that has to do with your excellent parenting skills. It really does.
I'm sure there's
many, many parents that don't spend the time, even the 30-hour minimum that parents are required to spend with their kids. Now, we're looking at those that do not have the parenting that's really going to take the time to work with their student. Those are the ones we're concerned about.
Well, I just want to make one more comment. I don't want to... You know, there's other people, I'm sure, that want to talk about this, but I didn't work with the kids. They did it themselves, and that's also the beauty of online learning is it forces you to be engaged in the program. I mean, you must, if you go to sleep, the computer's going to go to sleep. You're not going to pass this course. You've got to get through these wickets, which I was glad, because I certainly wasn't going to do that, you know, lead the kids and to do it. If they wanted their license, by goodness, you better sit there and you better take the course and you better get through it. And that's the beauty of this online learning. It drives you through that. You must stay awake and you must stay engaged in that program. Well, I'm signed on to this bill, just so you know. I mean, early on I did, because I'm very much in favor of it. I just wanted to let you know. I'll just let it go at that.
Representative Leidinger, further questions or comments for the testifiers? Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Tom Nichols and Jan Alschweiger.
While you were away, only one of us got.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize for the bum brush, I think we call that. Okay. Mr. Hasen, please proceed.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Chip Hasen, and I'm the owner of Safeway Driving School. Safeway, just by background, has been graduating teen drivers for over 40 years, including over 4,000 last year. We do that in 13 classrooms and community ed programs here in the Twin Cities. I see that I'm listed on the agenda as testifying in opposition of this bill, but that's not really quite accurate. Safeway hasn't been successful because we're unaware of what's attractive to customers. We know that online courses can be convenient and effective. And just as there are plenty of online high school courses in Minnesota, there's no reason why driver's education shouldn't be one of them. However, before I make a proposal to you, I want to clear up a couple of misconceptions. We are considering this bill to address the convenient option, not to address the safety concern. As you heard, the best the proponents tell you is that there has been no study that says that online is less safe. That's different from saying that online is safer. Let me give you a thought experiment. Last fall, there were a number of teen deaths in a five-week period and a brief period of headlines. And I don't think any of you said to yourself, you know, we've got to make it easier for teens to get their driver's license. More likely, you or your constituents wondered whether we should raise the minimum drinking age, which Senator Klobuchar proposed at the time, or to increase the classroom time to 40 hours from 30, or increase behind the wheel to 10 from 6, or to take additional classroom training after you started behind the wheel lessons. All of these, by the way, are recommendations of the national standards that Ms. Prudhomme mentioned earlier. None of the national standards talk about convenience, however. I don't believe this bill is constituent-driven. There are 260 public schools that offer driver's ed in Minnesota and another 130 commercial schools. In fact, driver's ed courses are all over the place. And not surprisingly, Minnesota's Driver and Vehicle Services Division reports almost no calls from parents wondering why there are no options, why there aren't more options. Will they take online if it's offered? Sure they will. But to a certain extent, this is a solution looking for a problem. So if this isn't safety-driven or constituent-driven, why does this bill keep coming up? Well, I think it does because Minnesota has 52,000 teens taking driver's ed every year, and at $100 a student, that's a $5.2 million revenue opportunity for driversed.com. This bill, as it's written and as it's been introduced 2 years ago and 3 years ago, does address convenience, and I think that's why its authors have proposed it, and that's the part I like about it. They're on the right track. There's no reason Minnesota parents and teens shouldn't be offered a convenient option of online driver's ed. But it's also written to open Minnesota to the California-based company of driversed.com, which I'm less enthusiastic about. I do worry about instructors, and I think you should consider them too. There are about 1,300 licensed driving instructors, classroom instructors in the state. If half of the students go online, that's been Indiana's guess. They introduced online about 18 months ago, and they think that about half of the students now take it. That's 650 instructors without a job. Now, there's never a good time to consider a bill that will eliminate Minnesota jobs and ship Minnesota revenues to California, but that's what we're doing today, and I just think you ought to be aware of that. The proponents say that this will free up classroom instructors for behind-the-wheel training. Maybe. I think it's going to eliminate jobs. I want to address the issue of this backstop. It's a tragic misconception that somebody thinks that if you get 32 multiple choice or true-false questions right, you're qualified to drive. It is not the case. Minnesota requires 30 hours of classroom instruction so that teachers can impact students' attitude, their sense of responsibility, and not so that they can teach them how many feet behind a school bus you've got to stop. Finally, online proponents have stated that adult driving instructors can get their education online, so why can't drivers themselves? Well, it's a good point. St. Cloud State University does offer online driving instructor training. However, what the proponents don't mention is that it is teacher-led at specific times and days, just like a real class, with remote students connected to the live classroom like closed-circuit TV delivered over the Internet. Questions can be asked, discussions are held, attendance is taken, and driversed.com's course is nothing like that. In fact, driversed.com's course is terrific. You didn't see much of it up here, but for those of you who have been to see it, it's really excellent. It has well-organized content, it's clearly presented, it's got good illustrations and animations, it's got terrific videos. It's a very impressive product. But ultimately, it is what it is. It is 1,000-plus PowerPoint slides that you click through one after the other, and mind-numbing, 30 hours of this. It is, and while you're doing that, you are answering emails, you're updating Facebook, you're downloading the latest episode of Jersey Shore, and who knows what else. You mentioned how many students fall asleep. I don't know how many fall asleep, but I'll ask the question, how many will pay attention when there's a 20-minute video playing and you've got Facebook on the other side of your screen? I'm afraid that a lot of them will be doing Facebook. And why? Well, because teens have crashes, lack of, I'm going to get to this point because I want to make it, just a second. Teens have crashes because they're immature, because they have a high propensity for taking risk, because they have the illusion of invulnerability, they don't recognize hazards. That's the same reason I believe that they will skip through 1,000 slides as quickly as they can. So what's the solution? How does Minnesota get the convenient option of online education, which is a worthy goal, and still deliver local content and teacher impact? Well, good news is Minnesota has invented that wheel already. There are existing statutes related to online education. Existing Minnesota statutes require that online classes be teacher-led, like the St. Cloud State driving instructor course that the proponents compare themselves to. By the way, that's also the recommendation of the national standards I mentioned earlier, which says that if online education is used in teen driver's education, that the online education be teacher-led. Therefore, my proposal to you is to amend House File 615 to make it clear that you, in fact, mean a teacher-led online class. I've distributed out there an amendment which essentially replaces the words, quote, internet-based theory driver education program, unquote, with the words, quote, teacher-led online learning program. My language copies the terminology in Minnesota statutes 124D.095, which deals with online learning. I believe the change will address both the convenience of online driver's education and the impact of being teacher-led. It will reflect Minnesota standards for online education, and in doing so will be a Minnesota solution, not a California solution. And it's a change I believe driving educators will support. Safeway certainly would. Thank you.
Further questions for the testifiers? Representative Leidiger.
Well, I have to make another comment on this in teacher-led versus student-led working its way through an online learning program. You know, what we're forgetting here is where the responsibility lies. It's not the parents' or the teacher's responsibility to get the kid through passing a test. It's the child himself must get him through that test. And that's the beauty of this, of online learning or e-learning. I mean, he can't, a person taking this course is not going to pass the test at the end unless he has gone through the course.
That isn't true.
Well,
here's what happens in driversed.com.
Mr. Hayson.
I'm sorry.
I don't think I'm finished.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
I will call on you.
Thank you.
Certainly.
I'm sorry.
First of all, it is true. You have to. It is true that you'll pass a test only if you get through the courseware. I mean, leave the burden on the child who's trying to get their license. Don't be spoon feeding the kid through a teacher. This is a great bill to get us out of this idea that you've always got to have the teacher in front of the classroom in order to pass. I mean, you cannot regulate a kid in the class that's daydreaming through the whole thing. The good thing about online learning is you got to get through all that material. You got to pass the test before you can move on. And so I'm all for this bill. I think it's time we start looking at online learning in a lot of our requirements here.
Thank you. Mr. Hayson, please.
Yeah, I apologize for that.
No, that's quite all right. It's you have to kind of learn the protocol around here. That's what I'm here for.
The driversed.com program does have a class at the end of each of its segments. It does have a test at the end of each of its segments.
Representative Leidiger, let the members finish, please. Yeah. Mr. Hayson, could you direct your comments to me? That'd be helpful.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It does have a test at the end of each of its segments. And if you fail at the test, if you don't answer enough of the 10 questions correctly, it gives you the test again. And it gives you the test again. And eventually you will get 7 questions right or whatever the number is, and you will move on. So on the one hand, you do have to pass a test to move on. On the other hand, it's not quite, I think, what you're thinking. You just keep answering until you get them all right or get enough right.
Well, thank you for your comments. There are further follow-up on that, too, but you done, Representative?
Okay.
Who's Representative Morrow? And then a couple others would like to respond to this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to be more of a moderating voice in the middle of this in the sense that, Representative Leidiger, I think students learn both ways. I think some students learn in a classroom with a great teacher up front. And I agree with you, Representative Leidiger, that some students may learn better in an online version. I know you didn't mean to disparage all teachers when you said you can't learn in front of a teacher-based classroom. I know maybe Professor Benson and I are both smiling a little bit as you as we think about that. Mr. Chair, that's really all I wanted to say. I want to be careful that we don't start disparaging an entire profession, but rather we can maybe agree that students learn in a variety of ways.
Well, thank you, Representative, for your comments. I appreciate them. Seeing no further questions for the witnesses, there are 2 other testifiers that would like to testify, and then I'm going to call Representative Biskins back for a follow-up to the little exchange that just happened. So if I could ask Jan and Tom Nichols, if you'd come down. Representative Biskins, could you yield for just a moment?
Mr. Chair, I do want to address the testimony from the gentleman from Safeway because there was disparaging remarks made towards the author of this bill that I do need on the record immediately, Mr. Chairman.
Can you hold, Representative Biskins, please, can you hold that thought? We're going to get to you in just a moment, and the gentleman behind you, I think, also deserves a response to that. But if you can hold for just a moment, I would like these 2 other testifiers, and I'd like to wrap this bill up in the next 9 minutes. So you will come back. Thank you, Representative. And is there Tom Nichols here to make a few comments? And if I could ask you both, we've plowed a lot of ground. Some of it we're starting to cover again. If you could, new information would be appreciated by this committee, and concisity, if that's a word, would be appreciated. Ms. Allsweiger, would you like to go first, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allsweiger, representing Education Minnesota. And this is proposed as an option, absolutely. But I do want you to think about these individuals, if they are not properly prepared, will be the individuals that will be on your highway, your son or daughter's highway. And we're concerned about safety overall. Yes, you do have to pass the test, and I believe that there are some limits to how often you can take that test. But it doesn't mean that someone else can't be in the room with you while you're taking that test. so someone else could be helping provide the answers. Yes, there is security built in, but I know my son's favorite colors and favorite sports teams, or I could be sitting right beside my son as he's filling in the beginning portion that says, what are the security questions? Education Minnesota is mostly concerned about the quality instruction. In a classroom situation, you have situations where a student comes in and talks about an event that happened on the road over the weekend. And it might be that his mother was driving and someone's behind, and there's a possible road rage coming up with somebody tailgating. You can have real discussions about that situation that affects people's behavior. Someone mentioned a video game, so I really won't get into that texting and so on. I do want to point out that kids are challenging. They've got a lot of interest, right? When in 2008, I believe, this legislation was kind of morphed into a study. And the Department of Public Safety in Minnesota had to come out with some findings. They did not have to come to a conclusion. But some of the contributing factors in teen crashes, they stated, are not items that will be on a test. I'd like you to listen to these. Immaturity, lack of driving experience, a high propensity for risk-taking behaviors, an illusion of invulnerability, deficient decision-making because of the area of teens' brain is involved in rendering judgments typically is not fully developed at that age. My point is that these are not items that are addressed in a test, but are better addressed in classroom discussion. All of you probably could, if you have relatives who know any kids who are 8 or 9 or 10 years old, they could all tell you that red means stop, green means go. And as they get a little older, they can go through, you know, they could take these tests and probably do well on some more sophisticated questions. The issue is the decision making. And should I go on yellow? Or should I, what should I do when this person is tailgating me? These are all issues that you discuss in a classroom situation. And we would hope that you would not support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Yes, Tom Nichols. I'm the owner of Sears Driving School. We serve about 850 students in St. Paul, adults and teenagers in St. Paul and Minneapolis. And thank you for the opportunity. I'll be brief. I know you folks have listened to all these things, and what I have to say is not much different from what other folks have been saying about this particular legislation. I'm opposed to this legislation, and I'll mention just a couple of reasons. The first one, which is fairly obvious to me, I think, is that teenagers have a tendency to pay more attention if there is an educator up in front of them in the classroom. I've been a classroom educator for a long, long time, and they have a tendency to pay attention more, to stay awake, to not be out in the kitchen having a sandwich or any of those kinds of things when there is an individual in front of them teaching these particular things. And these are important kinds of concepts, things like drunk driving and driving on freeways and no texting, and those kinds of things can be very, very dangerous to young people. Those are the kinds of things that I think a lot of us are emphasizing these days. So, again, I think that's a very obvious point. The second point, and I know this has been brought up many, many times, the second point I want to mention is that I believe if this legislation goes through, it appears to me that a lot of the money that is currently being spent on driver's education would be sent off, excuse me, would be sent off to California or another state. And I think it is in the interest of Minnesota citizens, small businesses, and I'm sure you folks are all in support of small businesses, such as mine, and their employees, that it is in the interest of those small businesses and their employees that this legislation not be passed, because I think we're going to lose a lot of those small businesses and a lot of their employees as a result of the changes that this legislation could have. So thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I certainly would enjoy answering them.
Thank you, Mr. Nichols. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Questions? And I don't have any other testifiers on the list, but I just got a note that Pat from DVS. Pat, would you like to speak to this? And Becky, who do you have here?
He's on the list. Shokrat.
Yes, okay, I'm sorry. It's on another list here. Mr. Shokrat, did you hear the last gentleman? He was 2 minutes and 30 seconds and said exactly what was on his mind. The chair really appreciated that. And it mostly hit the different points. So if you go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Rod Shokrat from AAA Minneapolis. I am the Vice President of Marketing, but I also represent our traffic safety efforts. The AAA clubs of Minnesota believe that an online component to driver education can be appropriate and effective if done well and there is effective oversight. We've been actively engaged, as many of you know, for many years in efforts to better prepare novice drivers. Driver training is, after all, about the efforts to prepare novice drivers, and it's much more than teaching people about our laws in order to pass the state exam. It's about teaching them to safely operate a complicated and dangerous piece of equipment that could and often does take someone's life when not used properly. We are concerned by some existing online driver education courses that we believe are ineffective, and we are concerned by the experience of some states with, in our view, insufficient oversight and or coordination of online driver education is an ongoing issue. In terms of quantity and quality, there are at least 40 providers of online driver education schools operating today, probably more. Some are, in our view, very poor substitutes for a classroom experience because they have low student engagement and very little, if any, ways to prevent fraud. For example, one course recently studied by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, apparently uses the same questions for all final exams, though the order of the questions varied from test to test. Another had at most two versions. Again, according to NHTSA, other common issues with some online providers included highly abbreviated training, example, a couple hours to complete the entire course, or no need to take the course at all, just go right to the test. Answers to tests readily available online through online forums, insufficient identification verification. And conversely, we do agree that some courses like driversed.com appear to be highly interactive, rich in multimedia content. They have chat features and acceptable levels of security, but many do not. In terms of oversight and coordination of the online driver education programs in our state, we are concerned by the potential to move the oversight of this component of driver ed from the Department of Public Safety to another agency. DPS is the expert in this field, and driver education is a public safety matter. It's worth noting that in California, the provision that allowed internet-based training made it possible for some online driver schools, driver education schools, to register as private secondary schools and therefore allowed to circumvent the normal oversight of the California Department of Motor Vehicles. In summary, we have concerns with this bill in its current format due to its lack of quality assurance and effective oversight. We hope appropriate time and effort is taken to do this the right way. We have opened channels of communications with the bill's authors and would like to work with them on measures that would help ensure the effectiveness of any future online driver education program in Minnesota. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Shulcott. Questions? Seeing none, Ms. McCormick, welcome to the committee. I might point out to Mr. Shulcott that if this bill were to pass, your division would be responsible for the quality concerns he was just expressing. Ms. McCormick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And I would echo the comments that were just made regarding this legislation. The major concern that we had has been addressed in the author's amendment, and so we're not objecting to the bill, but at the same time, we also have cautions that it says the department, but of public safety was taken out. There is some confusion because there are public school driver education teachers that are not licensed by DPS. They are licensed by the Department of Education, but they still must follow the rules and regulations that are in Chapter 171 that includes driver education. So that was one concern that I think was raised with the author. And then secondly, I also wanted to point out that in the report that we did in 2009 on driver education, our biggest concern is that we have some oversight so that we can exercise a great deal of control over the content and delivery of the program. And I think that is outlined in this report. And if any of the members have not received a copy of this report, I can send an email copy for their review so that they would be able to look at those recommendations. But I think that if we can work together, then we would certainly support looking at both models, but we would need to have strict security measures and ensure that we had oversight of the curriculum that might be involved.
Ms. McCormick, thank you. Members, if any of you want to get refreshed on that report, please let the committee administrator know, and we'll see that that gets sent out to you. Questions for Ms. McCormick? Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Now, Representative Biskins, the gentleman from California, I think, took a little bit of a beating. If he'd like to come back and respond, that'd be great. Representative Biskins, you have the last word before we lay this bill over for possible consideration on Wednesday.
Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you very much.
Mr. Ziffrin, please.
Thank you, Chairman, committee. I was impressed by the kind words that most everyone had to say about the driversed.com course. Just wanted to simply clarify, we have a large question pool. People do not see the same questions again. They might see one or two of the same questions, but never the same test. That's a minor point. I'd also like to echo something that Ms. McCormick from Department of Public Safety said. Yes, we invite regulation. Any Minnesota-specific online course that we would apply for would be a Minnesota-specific curriculum. Thank you.
Questions for the testifier? Members, Representative Biskins, thank you for your indulgence. Let us get through that. I know you have a few comments, and then Representative Morrow has a question, but please proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things. Number one, the gentleman from Safeway, I thought, besides his disparaging and insulting remarks towards children, I think also took a shot at the motivation of the author. Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, we've had two Minnesota companies that are interested in looking at online learning. It is not my intent, nor has it ever been, to benefit to the tune of $5.2 million and California company, as was insinuated. And I know that this is a passionate issue, and over and over again, the parade of people opposing the bill, it's their jobs, right? And it's their livelihoods. And I understand that. I get that. But things change, and times change, and the only person who is actually a parent of a student who actually had children going through online learning is a member of this committee, and he speaks very highly of it. And I think that that's something for us to remember. And if there is a parade of parents whose kids have been severely harmed by online learning, well, this bill will get more committee hearings, and I hope we see that parade coming forward. Members of the committee, it is not the intent of this author to remove the Department of Public Safety from oversight. I know that in a couple of places of the bill that is stricken, and it is stricken only for form. Section 171.05 is a section where typically the words commissioner points to the commissioner of public safety. But as this bill moves to public safety, if it brings comfort to the commissioner to put those words back, we can certainly do that. You know, the legislature has not been averse to redundancy in the past, nor will it be in the future, and it's not my aim to eliminate that. Members of the committee, I thank you very much for allowing me to testify. One final point, and we'll see this on Monday, there is a small fiscal note that was provided by the Department of Public Safety because of some rulemaking costs, a fiscal note of $30,000 one-time dollars. When we bring this back before the committee on Wednesday, I will have an amendment which deals with an application fee to help ensure that the providers are serious about that, to have an application fee, which will then hopefully bring this to a zero-sum game. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
If you'd hold for just a moment, Representative Biskins, Representative Morrow, you have the final question.
Just a couple questions I'll need answered at some point. I don't expect it to be answered now. First, Mr. Chair, one question I'll have is whether this bill will go through K-12 policy as well. I'm not looking for an answer for that right now, but it seems as though there's some interaction with existing statute on homeschooled children and their availability to driver's ed right now. Representative Biskins, while this testimony was going on, I reviewed very quickly just the executive summary of the May 2010 Wisconsin report on Internet Education Driver Safety Internet Driver Education Study. Excuse me, and this is a May 2010 study. I don't know, Representative Biskins, or whether there are others out there as well, but just reviewing the executive summary of the Wisconsin study, there were some interesting notes that I saw. One about it's difficult to tell right now whether on crash statistics versus online ed versus classroom ed for drivers. But Representative Biskins, one thing that was stated here that I'd like you to think about before Wednesday is the degree of instructor involvement in an online course. The Wisconsin study suggests that online education includes instructor involvement. This could be a discussion board. This could be where the student has to interact online with an instructor, asking questions, raising comments, and like that seems to raise the level of engagement. And I would at least ask you to consider whether there are ways to have an instructor involvement section that might get past some of these walking into the kitchen, not paying attention, just taking a multiple choice test. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Representative Biskins, taking notes.
I have, Mr. Chairman, and I would ask that Representative Morrow, if you have an opportunity to share that study with me. I have not had the opportunity to.
Thank you. With that, members, we will lay over House Bill 615, perhaps to see you again on Wednesday.
Thank you.
Thank you for the good discussion. Representative Anderson has House Bill 867, more driving instruction and permit issues. And with him will be Professor John Palmer from Mr. John Palmer from St. Cloud. And while they're getting ready, if somebody would like to move House File 867 to get in front of the committee, and this one is also going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Don't everybody jump at once. Representative Murray?
Mr. Chairman, I will move
that motion.
I will make that motion.
Outstanding. Thank you. The bill is before us. Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 867 is before you. I have two individuals that would like to testify on behalf of the bill, Mr. John Palmer and Mr. Dewey Mettler, and they will introduce themselves as they come to testify. House File 867 is a bill that amends two requirements governing when a person under age 18 can obtain an instruction permit. First, it allows issues of permit to someone who has not yet completed the classroom phase of driver's education, but one is enrolled in an approved driver's education program that uses simulation or behind-the-wheel instruction. 2, completes at least 15 hours of classroom instruction, and 3, completes at least one behind-the-wheel lesson. Under current law, someone younger than 18 must have completed the classroom phase in order to be eligible for an instruction permit. Second, the bill modifies the set and order of precedence of adults who can approve the application for an instruction permit. Such approval is one of the statutory requirements for obtaining the permit. And without my going into further talking about this bill, I would like to have my testifiers testify on behalf of the bill. So I'll step aside and let my first testifier speak.
Mr. Palmer, I assume you're first.
Yes, I believe that's the order. I think I'll slide over and let Mr. Medler have
that'd be great.
The mic. Representative Anderson has two handouts for you. I expect that there'll be a test on these in the morning. That's a joke. I'm a professor at St. Cloud State.
Representative Anderson, thank you. Give it to Paige. And Mr. Palmer, if you'd identify yourselves for the
Yes, I'm John Palmer from St. Cloud, Minnesota. I'm a professor of health and safety at St. Cloud State, currently on administrative leave as associate provost. I do not speak for the university. I speak for myself. One of the handouts is simply informational for you. This is the national standard promulgated by NHTSA for states to qualify for federal funding under the Highway Safety Act and its successors. And it provides to you information I think you may find useful as you look at issues that affect driver education. I've been a teacher of teachers and a teacher of high school students for over 40 years. My doctoral dissertation, which was defended 30 years ago, was on the role and funding of Minnesota driver education. So I do have some interest in this field. I'm a past president of the professional association of that's called the American Driver and Traffic Safety Education Association. I'm currently editor for their scholarly publication, and I'm a reviewer for the Journal of Safety Education, which is published by the National Safety Council. The second handout that I gave you is more specific. It is an excerpt from the national standards for driver education and training that I felt were relevant. And actually, the only page that I want to call your attention to is page 3. These are standards taken from the section that deal with leadership, management, and administration of each school's program. And I want to call your attention to point 1.122, because the bill that Representative Anderson brings to you today directly addresses this. That standard says that a state should ensure that instruction of novice teens is completed using concurrent integrated classroom and in-car instruction, where the bulk of the classroom instruction occurs close in time to the in-car instruction to ensure maximum transfer of skills. Some people have referred to this as the means by which you can apply the skill you learn in classroom. I know that the chairman has some interest in flight, and the analogy here is that you do flight school and flight time in an integrated way so that what's learned in flight school can be applied to flight. In 1968, when I began my studies of traffic safety education, concurrent integrated instruction was the norm. 2 years ago, or now 3 years ago, that norm has been affirmed in the national standards. For some unexplained reason, Minnesota is the only state in the United States that prohibits best practice. In statute, you cannot teach an integrated program of classroom and behind the wheel. We believe that the language that is in Representative Anderson's bill carves out a reasonable ground for that by requiring 15 hours of classroom and at least one behind-the-wheel lesson prior to the student being able to go out and practice with the adult. We hope that we can be successful in having Minnesota return to being a state that celebrates best practice in education. And I brought with me Dewey Mettler, who is from Duck Lake now, I guess?
Madison Lake.
Madison Lake. Dewey taught in the Mankato District for years. He taught in a concurrent integrated program. And Dewey is bashful, but I'll let you know. Dewey has been recognized as a National Teacher of the Year in driver education.
Mr. Mettler, before you proceed, I just want to do a couple housekeeping things for the folks in the audience. It is apparent that we're going to have to come back this evening for a little bit. So those of you that came to testify, particularly against for the Torkelson bill or for the storm sewer, the Beard bill on railroad storm sewers, we will attempt to take those up along with the other two smaller bills, the Keel bill and the train crews exempted, after about probably 4:30, 5 o'clock-ish. I'm anticipating about another hour and a half this evening. We will make the announcement on the floor as to what room we can have. I'm anticipating we can come back here, but I'm not certain. But members, if you'll listen, 15 minutes after the adjournment of session, we will reconvene here. So those of you that came to testify, if you can go have a cup of coffee at one of the local establishments or something and come back, we would appreciate that. I'm sorry that this ran a lot longer than I thought it was going to. I really wanted to get the Torkelson bill teed up today, but we'll do that right after session. So, Mr. Mettler, if you'd identify yourself and speak to the to why this is a good idea, we'd appreciate it.
Dwayne Mettler, Madison Lake, Minnesota. I had the opportunity to teach the four-phase program on a semester basis for a half credit. This was classroom, simulation, behind the wheel, but most important, we had 12-car and a 6-car driving range at West and East High School in Mankato. The rule used to be that you could have 15 hours of classroom and then you could take the permit test. This is the best practice. It's get them in the tool, the vehicle, soon. It's important as far as the interest that is generated, because as we know and we've heard today, most important is the student. Try to save their lives. Well, those programs went by the wayside, but we're very interested in getting the concurrent program, so if I can have them in the classroom for 15 hours, or if you would want to amend to 20 hours, they go get their permit. Now they get 1 hour behind the wheel with the student, and then you'd finish in the classroom, or you could continue in some of our smaller school districts. You may only have your classroom on a Saturday, 3 hours from 9 to 12 or from 1 to 4, or you run it in the summertime. Maybe you're going to go 10 days in the classroom, and then you could take them behind the wheel, and then you could integrate and run your concurrent program with the two phases of classroom and behind the wheel.
Thank you, Mr. Mettler. I appreciate it. I understand that importance of the bill is so that kids who are taking classroom theory can actually get into an automobile at the same time. Apparently that is not permitted under current law. Is that correct, Doctor?
That is correct, Representative Beard. I want to make it clear that this is a change that allows the practice as opposed to mandating the practice. This simply gives the option to the deliverer of the program to engage in best practice. You can imagine what happens when Minnesotans attend national conferences and discussions occur, and it comes to light that we're not even allowed by statute to do what is in the rest of the United States considered to be best practice.
Thank you. Further questions for the testifiers or for the author, Representative Hausman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The juxtaposition of these two bills that we've just heard at this point now, I find incredibly humorous, because we've just heard a huge defense of the status quo for safety. But now we hear that we're the only ones in the country that do it that way. So I just think this discussion in light of the one we just had is quite interesting.
Perhaps we should have reversed the order of the agenda and
Mr.
heard this
Chairman,
one first. Dr. Palmer.
I would have appreciated that. I would have been back in St. Cloud by 3.
Riley noted, Dr. Palmer. Further questions for these folks before we lay this bill over for possible inclusion? Members, I think we can, hearing none, seeing none, thank you. We will lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Peel, I think we can probably slide the emergency vehicles in yet, and this bill will have to go to public safety, since there's flashing lights involved. Apparently they want to see it. And with that, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Murdoch, and members, if you'll be paying attention here, we'll tell you what room and what time an announcement on the floor. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Kyle, welcome to the committee.
That happens quite often. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is just a really, should be a real basic...
excuse me, you need to move your bill.
Oh, yeah, good idea.
Yeah.
Can I, I would like to move House File 922. It needs to go to Department of Public Safety after it's heard here.
On to Public Safety. Okay, and you have an author's amendment?
I do.
I'd like to move that?
Yes, I would also like to move the amendment. Changes after general on line 1.2, we need to add transportation. So it reads general transportation. Excuse me, on 1.13. Excuse me. So it reads not for general transportation purposes. So.
Okay, members, all in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? And the amendment's adopted. Okay, Representative, to your bill.
Yes, this bill permits us to, that vehicles that have red or colored lights, antique, restored emergency vehicles, and allow them to be used in various parades, I'm trying to think of the other displays, thank you, that so that they can be used at that time. But, you know, and would also have the classic lights, the license plates on, identifying them as classic cars. But Mr. Straczynski is here to explain it in depth, and I'll let him go.
Okay, Mr. Straczynski, I got that one right. I butchered hers, but that's all right. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Street Rod Association, as well as the Minnesota Fire Chiefs, Fire Marshals, Fire Departments, and arson investigators, and what have you. This bill is pretty direct and simple, but I do have 45 minutes worth of prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor of the bill, say aye.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill is pretty simple. A lot of departments here in the metro area and throughout all of Minnesota are restoring antique fire trucks and antique ambulances. I'm passing some pictures around that came from our museums. And you see these vehicles at parades, and you see these vehicles at back to the 50s and events like that. But technically they're illegal because the lights on these vehicles are non-conforming to current legal standards for who can display blue lights and red lights and where they have to be actually on the vehicle. So knowing that that's illegal, this legislation would say it's okay to have these vehicles and to drive them to and from, provided you have a special license plate which covers Street Rod, Pioneer, Classics, and what have you, and collectors. We chose that definition because they're not used for general transportation, so they're not used being driven on the streets every day as the personal drivers or for work or what have you. And it's pretty simple and straightforward. And I, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I did talk to Major Ken Urquhart about a provision which would probably want to add some language that satisfies the Highway Patrol's concerns. And we'll want to say at some point in time, perhaps the next meeting, we can get an amendment drafted that says something like the lights authorized to be activated during this under this section shall not be activated while the vehicle is driving to and from an event or a parade. In other words, you can use them at a parade, and you can use them when the vehicle's on display, but not when you're going down the road on the highway. That's some language that the patrol would like to have. We're very comfortable with that as well. So it's pretty straightforward. It just makes these vehicles legal to drive them on the road without their lights on.
without the lights on. Okay, and you would amend that, make that amendment in public safety?
I would, yeah. I
next
would.
Committee?
Yes.
All right. Members, any questions? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I did, and I appreciate your proposing that amendment because that was something I did notice that's not clear in the bill, and I think that would cause problems if, you know, I don't know if you're, it's under the category of impersonating a police officer, but so as long as that's in there, I think we're good to go.
Mr. Chairman, members, the major's up here, and he and I have agreed to the language already, and so.
Yeah,
okay,
I think
thank
we'll,
you.
Yeah.
And Representative Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess, so Mr. Stradinsky, I can't even say it today. Anyway, so currently when these are driving, to legally transport them now, you'd have to put them on a trailer and trailer them to the event to be able to ride, drive them in the parade or have them on display. You could not drive them. So what we're doing here is allowing these to be driven to and from where they have to be, but we're not allowing them to use the lights and all that fun stuff.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, thank you. Good question. You'd have to either trailer the vehicle legally, to be legal under current law, or you'd have to put bags or something over each of the lights, which may become problematic and what have you. So that's exactly what this bill is designed to do. It lets you take it to the parade so it can be used in a parade, or take it to a classic vehicle event, and you can just drive it down the road legally as long as the lights are not turned on.
Thank you.
Members, any other questions of Bill and Deb? That's easier to say. Seeing none, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 922 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention, Policy and Finance. Well, that's a big committee. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? You're off to public safety.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, we will recess. We'll be in recess till 15 minutes past session, and we will be back here 15 minutes after the end of session. So with that, we're in recess.
I'll call the meeting back to order. And members, I owe you all a mea culpa for saying room 200 on the floor when I had this one firmly in mind. So we're in room 5. If you're missing anybody, you want to set a page up to 200. Actually, Travis, you already did put a sign up there that Beard goofed up. We're actually down to 5. Is that what it says? Good.
Yep, that's what it says. Beard goofed up.
Works for me. Okay, once again, set phasers to stun, please. And then the next bill on the calendar is House Bill 1032, Representative Torkelson. There you are. Representative Torkelson, we'll have to have somebody move your bill. One of the members, Representative Vogel.
Yes.
And this is to pass to the General Register, although we may hold it for possible inclusion as well. Is that your motion?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
That's a good motion.
Thank you.
Representative Torkelson, welcome to the committee. Do I understand there is a technical amendment that keeps MnDOT happy? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do not have an amendment prepared at this time. I believe MnDOT has some technical issues that will be addressed at another committee or possibly back in this committee if it goes into the omnibus.
We need to pull it back? Okay.
We'll just see.
Thank you. If you'd like to proceed with your testimony, we have some testifiers.
Thank you, Chairman Beard. This is a fairly simple, direct bill that deals with work hours for those involved in heavy industry. It's commonly called the 410s bill. It's not a new idea. It's an idea that's been rattling around the Minnesota legislature for quite some time, and in fact was carried, a similar bill was carried by Representative Marquardt in the past. It's now my privilege to carry this bill forward. I think it's a good bill. We have many construction workers in my district that end up working away from home, would like to work four 10-hour days, get their regular time in, and have a decent weekend with their families. They end up staying at the work site oftentimes because commuting is not practical when you're a long ways from home. So this bill would allow four 10-hour days to get their regular time in. Works better for workers and for contractors. We have a number of testifiers that will be speaking to the bill today, and since they know much more about the details of this issue than I do. I look forward to their testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Torkelson, before we call up the first testifier, Dave Semerad, is he still here? Dave, didn't Representative Lilly carry a bill similar to this for the airport workers? Do you recall? There was a 410s provision that was made there somewhere. Do you recall this recently?
Mr. Chair, I believe that Mr. Lilly's bill had more to do with trading shifts between workers.
Oh, okay. Representative Nelson, perhaps you can answer my question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason Representative Lilly carried that bill for the airline workers was because under their collective bargaining agreement, they were allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. But because they were no longer a union and they were decertified, they had fall back under Minnesota state rules, which they couldn't do it under Minnesota law. That's why, and it's, they do this in many states under their elsewhere, and so this is why we did that. And the workers were in agreement to it, so it's different than what we're going on here.
Thank you for raising the issue, Representative Nelson. Perhaps to the testifiers who are coming, one of the questions the committee is interested in is, can this be done now, absent the law, by collective bargaining, or is there something in our prevailing wage laws that require us to make this change so that the management and labor can negotiate that? That is a question I think we'd be interested in hearing about. Not that I'm telling you what to testify to, Mr. Semerad, but if you'd identify yourself, okay. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Semerad. I'm the CEO for the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. Thank you, Representative Torkelson, for sponsoring this bill. This proposed legislation is to modify the overtime provision of the state prevailing wage law as it applies only to state highway construction. It does not propose to change any other provision of the Minnesota state prevailing wage law, nor does it change overtime rules for building construction. The federal Davis-Bacon law and other federal statutes require that overtime is paid in excess of 40 hours in one work week. In Minnesota, state law dictates overtime at time and a half to be paid to construction workers after 8 hours in one day or 40 hours in one week. The proposed amendment would change the daily overtime threshold from 8 to 10. Overtime after 10 hours is common in the construction industry and other industries as well. Many states have adopted overtime after 10 hours for construction. This change would allow a construction worker to work 40 hours in 4 days with the remaining 3 days for an extended weekend and another day of rest. For many workers who drive a considerable distance to the project work site, a 4-day week will save on fuel and other expenses related to long commutes. It will also reduce traffic congestion at the work sites. For contractors, a 4-10-hour week provides for cost savings associated with being on the project site one less day per week, being another tool to help the contractor manage the project in a cost-efficient manner. While a 4-10-hour day schedule will not be used on every project, we believe on some projects it can be a successful alternative to traditional scheduling that has benefits for all stakeholders. Mr. Chairman and members, I'm also delivering this testimony on behalf of the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association. Ms. Dish was unable to come back after the after we had to leave earlier this afternoon. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy
Thank
to answer
you, Mr.
them.
Semerud, that was one of the questions I was going to ask is who couldn't make it back. Do you know if Mr. Mathewitz is still
here? Brian Mathewitz is still here. Mark Saline from Hawley, Minnesota was here. It was a contractor who had to leave. But I know Brian wants to speak as well.
Okay, so Mr. Saline and Ms. Dish had to leave.
Correct.
Our apologies for that. Members, questions for Mr. Semerad before we... Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that I understand the bill or the change, and it will either person can answer it. I thought I heard you say it was for highway projects, but it's for highway and heavy construction, which includes power plants, dams, utilities. Do I understand that correctly?
That's
Mr.
correct.
Semerad?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
So a definition of heavy construction project, because you mentioned specifically excluded buildings.
It would define that a little more, Mr. Chairman and members. The bill is not intended to change anything in the building sector, in the public building sector.
Follow up, Representative Moore.
Well, if I might, I'm looking at the rule itself, and the definition of highway and heavy construction means all construction projects which are similar in nature to those projects based upon bids as provided under Minnesota statute, and there's a reference for the construction and maintenance of highways or other public works, and includes roads, highways, airport runways, bridges, power plants, dams, and utilities. So I don't even think that's necessarily an exclusive list, Mr. Chair, because of the word includes.
Thank you, Representative Morrow, for the there is actually a legal definition in statute then, but it uses the word includes. Okay, thank you. You mentioned design. You didn't mention design build in that definition, did you? Mr. Semrad, before we call Mr. Mathiewicz, is your understanding, or give us your understanding of how this would affect the design build process, or does it affect it any differently than anything else?
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't think it would affect design build projects at all. It would affect design bid build projects, design build projects, and without any difference.
Without any different distinction. Thank you. That's what I want to know. Further questions for Mr. Semrad? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just might make a comment. It's my understanding that this would not take precedence over a negotiated contract. If the contract is negotiated for 8-hour days, that takes precedence over this change.
But to be clear, if the union wanted to, management wanted to agree to 4-10s, our statutes get in the way of that.
That is correct.
At the moment. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to maybe rebut a little what Representative Torkelson said was, while it doesn't get in the way of collective bargaining agreements, it sometimes can be used as pressure at the bargaining table to get the unions to switch their language in their contract to allow 4-10s because they say, well, now it's a state law, you should be able to do this. So it can be used as a pressure point against unions that don't want to do that.
Thank you. That reminds me of another question, but we'll wait for Mr. Melander. Further questions for Mr. Semrad? Thank you.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, I would like certainly to respond to Representative Nelson. We do have in our collective in a number of our collective bargaining agreements right now language that would allow for 4-10-hour work days on highway work and the related work. And the reason we cannot use that is because the state law will not allow it. So while it's we're able to use it for private sector work, we cannot use it for public sector work.
Okay. Thank you for the input. Appreciate it. Further comments? Sir, if you'd stick around for a little bit, I'm sure we'll be having more questions. Mr. Mathiewicz.
Thank you.
If you'd come down and identify yourself for the folks at home and for the record and proceed with your testimony, we'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, committee, my name is Brian Mathiewicz, President, CEO of Mathiewicz Construction Company, a highway heavy contractor. In support of this bill, it's a little known fact that quality of life is something we're struggling with our employees and trying to keep them in this industry, high quality people and operators. And a simple thing is the three big holidays that we have, Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day. Under the old system with the 8-hour day, whenever we have the 3 days off, the following Saturday becomes an automatic work day because we need our 5/8 to make everything work. So they all automatically know when they get a 3-day weekend, the next weekend they get a 1-day weekend. And so it kind of takes the luster out of quality of life because we don't have any flexibility to catch up the schedule. Under the 4-10s, of course, we could work 4-10s. In the week, in the days after a 3-day holiday. So that's a quality of life issue there. More and more employees, weddings, fishing, Saturday, even if modern schedules of contracts now, there's many phasing. You know, we're not building as many new highways as we are reconstructing highways. So you may have Wednesday that there's a traffic switch going on and we can't do any work. And so again, we lost our 8 hours. And where does that 8 hours go? It gets pushed back to Saturday, so now automatically they have to work Saturday. It's not overtime, it's regular time. And so there's many times that we completely lose the power to schedule their lives and help them be at their weddings and their families for Saturday because of the complexity of the projects. Again, a quality of life issue. Weather does also then also add into that equation and take away the scheduling opportunities. We could schedule our projects more aggressively if we could go with 410s right out of the chute when we do our scheduling and try to move them ahead, and that would also be another benefit of the 410s. Safety, of course, is the final point I want to make, is that every day that our crews drive early in the morning, leaving maybe their house at 5 a.m., and returning at 8 a.m., our biggest worry and most of our accidents that we see are fatigue, driving those mornings back and forth. In fact, last year we had 3 in the ditches of our crews, just fatigue. And so if we can eliminate one day on some regular basis to not have them driving 80 miles early in the morning and late at night, it'll be an incredible safety. And our whole program for our company is, we tell our people we want to send you home all in one piece at the end of a season, and this will just be another piece to help us do that. Thank you, Cuddy.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Mapowitz. One thing you said intrigued me, that you're sending them home tired and they'd be driving one less day a week, but wouldn't they be working 10 hours, be having to leave earlier in the morning and or coming back later at night, and therefore be having worked longer, be more fatigued, or have a bigger chance of being fatigued, and wouldn't that be more of a safety hazard than working an 8-hour day and driving home?
Mr. Mathewitz?
Each different type of construction probably would answer that slightly differently. We're in the highway heavy. We only get 6 months to do our work. We're working more than a 10-hour day anyway. So they're still going to get overtime probably each day. So the length of our day won't change. And they're still going to get overtime, and so the day won't change much, but we'll have more flexibility.
Follow up, Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Mathewitz, Mr. Chair, thank you. So that's with another question I had in my mind, but I wasn't going to ask it, but you raised it. My understanding of highway heavy projects, especially highway projects, because of the 6-month time period of work, that most of these people aren't just working 10-hour days, they're working 12-hour days, and usually and sometimes 5, 6, 7 days a week at those 12-hour days when the rush is on to get these projects done. So why do we need to change the 8-hour day part of it?
Mr. Mathewitz?
Mr. Chairman, there's definitely some times where it's not going to have an impact. It's not going to impact all the time. What it does do is, when you get scheduling and like the 3-day weekends I was talking about and rain events that come into it, that we can still get the reasonable amount of work done in the 5 days without going to Saturday automatically. So it does give us the opportunity to catch up during the week and not take away from their weekend as soon as there's a glitch or a 1-day rain out or whatever. So it just gives a lot of flexibility, and our crews pressure us to work more hours during the week so they can have the weekends off, but oftentimes we're the ones saying, no, we got to have our 8 hours of regular time on Saturday, and messes up their weekend and the wedding plans that they have.
Follow up, Representative Nelson. Representative Morrow. Mr. Mathewitz, how many of your employees, or how often is it that employees will come and take a room in a motel for 3 or 4 or 5 nights? Does that happen? Will this have some impact on that at all?
Absolutely, yes. They will have a cost savings of one less hotel room, because I would say 70% of the time our folks are in a hotel room or a camper or some means of stay if they're not driving.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mathewitz, I'm a little confused, so I need you to clear this up for me. You made a statement on Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day that automatically meant that they were going to have a short weekend. So are you telling me that you don't pay holiday pay?
Mr. Mathewitz?
Like a 3-day week at Memorial Day, they would be off. We would have Saturday, Sunday, Monday off like everyone and do their thing. The following Saturday, since we would only have 4 days to Friday to get our eights in, the following Saturday would be a regular 8-hour day. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guthrie.
Mr. Mathewitz, that didn't answer my question. My question was, are you telling me you don't pay them for the holiday?
Mr. Mathewitz.
Or are you making them work the additional Saturday?
Mr. Chair, I mean, I may not understand the question exactly, but all of our employees are hourly employees, okay. So they're paid by the hour.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guthrie.
Let me try to clear it up. When I worked for a non-union shop, if I had the 4th of July off, I got paid for that day. Didn't mean I had to work an extra day. That's what I'm asking you.
Mr. Mathewitz, perhaps I can help Representative Gauthier phrase the question. In a regular 40-hour, 5-day week, a holiday generally means a paid holiday where you end up working 4 days but still get paid for the day that was the holiday, President's Day, Memorial Day, 4th of July. How does that work in the construction world?
In the construction world, Mr. Chair, most companies do not pay. In fact, very few. With the Davis-Bacon rules and everything, there's no holiday pay on days that you do not work.
So if you do not work on the 4th of July, you don't get paid. If you worked on the 4th of July, what would happen then? I'm curious.
Then you would get paid. Likely it would be overtime, which would be time and a half, or in some cases under collective bargaining agreements, it would be double time.
Thank you.
If you worked.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Mathewitz before we have next testifier come down? If you'd stand by, I would appreciate it. I'm looking at my list here. Edward Reynoso, did you make it? Great. Thank you for cutting us some slack and sticking around. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if you could deviate a little bit from the schedule and allow Harry Melander to go before me.
Certainly.
He has a prior
yeah.
commitment. So.
Thank you for notifying us. Harry, or Mr. Melander, please. I'm sorry, I didn't know you had a... But
no, that's... Listen, I apologize. These are busy times for all of us. My name's Harry Melander, Mr. Chairman. I work with the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council and also the St. Paul Building and Construction Trades Council. But I've been before. Our group represents construction workers throughout the state of Minnesota. Our group is in opposition to the bill that's presently in front of you, as we think it's much broader than it needs to be. We believe that the 8-hour day is something that's good for all Minnesotans, and that any type of deviation from that only would hinder the quality of life for all Minnesota workers, whether they're affiliated with a group such as ours or just independent of ours. So. We appreciate the comments that came from our partners, the AGC, but the present structure of the bill we're in opposition to.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Melander? Can you wait for just a couple minutes
sure.
here while Mr. Reynoso speaks, and there may be a couple of questions. Mr. Reynoso, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32. Which represents 62,000 members across four states and Minnesota, including being one of them. We represent a considerable amount of members in the highway-heavy construction industry, many in your districts, that believe that this bill would be detrimental to their way of life, and the fact that this would be a cut in pay to their existence and the ability to earn wages. First of all, from my understanding, there's nothing that prohibits 4/10, Mr. Chair. What it does is you have to pay overtime for anything over 8. So this, plain and simple, is a way to do away with the 8-hour day. The fact is that if you work 4/10, you get overtime between the 8th and 10th hour. It's always been a premium. Throughout the industry, it's been a premium to work. If you make an employee work beyond 8 hours, it's a premium of time and a half. And this isn't going to create any new jobs. And you may hear some of the supporters of this bill say that this may create some new jobs. There's no guarantees that it will create any jobs, period. There is one guarantee, is that members of my union and the non-union will bring home less money. They are guaranteed of a pay cut. Now, I know at the beginning of this session, we talked about jobs, 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 jobs. This does nothing to create jobs. This hurts working people. union and non-union alike. And this does away, plain and simple, with the eight-hour day. We are adamantly opposed to House File 1032, and we ask for your support in opposition. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Reynoso or Mr. Melander? Representative Leidiger.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, how do you figure that they're going to make less money? I mean, I'm trying to understand that. I mean, in this bill, it talks about they'll get additional dollars beyond the 40-hour work week. Now, whether that's 5/8 or 4/10, you know, as long as they're within the 40 hours, they get their pay. If it's beyond 40 hours, they would get additional pay. So I guess the point I'm making here is currently, right now, they're working their 40 hours. They're working 4 or 5 8-hour days. Is that correct? I mean, do you have statistics that says that if they move them to, you know, the 4-hour, 10-hour days, that they're going to somehow make less money? I don't get that. I don't get that.
I mean, if they're already... To which testifier are you directing your question, or either?
To
Mr. Reynoso?
Reynoso, please.
Mr. Reynoso.
Mr. Chair and member of the committee, you know, the fact is that right now they're currently working beyond 8 hours. If you're in the highway heavy, many of them that are working currently right now beyond the 8 hours get that overtime. They will no longer have that overtime. They'll be working those 4/10s, and those 2 hours of overtime that they're going to be working during those 4/10 will no longer be that premium after 8. And that's where they would lose. So if they go to the 4/10s and don't work that fifth day, they're going to lose that premium on those between the 8th and 10th hour.
Can I just follow up? I mean, they could conceivably work a fifth day of 10 hours and get that overtime. I mean, I just heard one of the contractors say, Mr. Matheson, say that, I mean, he's working the people the full 6 months while they're able to work. I mean, if... There could be an argument made that they're going to make additional money because he's going to work that fifth day and work a 10-hour fifth day. That's 50 hours.
I'm asking the question.
Okay. Mr.
Reynoso.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the fact is that they'll probably still work that fifth day, but they're going to lose that premium between the 8th and 10th hour. When you work 10 hours in a day, right now, currently, on that between the 8th and 10th hour, you are going to get time and a half, correct? So if you're going to get time and a half and you're going to work that fifth day, you're losing that overtime for that between the 8th and 10th hour. That premium pay.
Okay. Another follow-up?
Just 2 hours a day is 10 hours. And if you're working 50 hours, you could work that 10 hours on the fifth day. I mean, it's one and the same. What we're asking for is flexibility here. I think that's what this provides, is the flexibility to be able to do this. I don't see how anybody's losing dollars.
Well, Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I apologize for walking in late. I mentioned to you I had a previous meeting, and I didn't hear what your intent was for this bill.
The intent was, and I'll just speak frankly to the members, because some of us have
talked
offline, was that it'll pass to the general register. There is no Senate companion to this bill yet. The understanding was that there is work to be done on this bill on the Senate file, and then we will work from that perspective. That's what I was going to ask the committee.
And I see our lead, Representative Hornstein, wanted to come in as well. But what I would at least mention from my own personal view, Mr. Chair, is it seems like we have a couple of things going on here. One, we have a difference in industries that may be important for this bill. It may be that what happens in highway construction is different than what happens in power plant construction. I don't know enough to know whether that's a meaningful difference. I don't know... what this does to jobs. I truly do have questions I would like to have answered. I would encourage perhaps laying the bill over so we could get these questions answered. Maybe there is a distinction that's important that we understand when it comes to highway construction. But once we put it on the general register, we don't get to have that discussion again. But maybe that Representative Beard was looking to follow up, or Hornstein was looking to follow up.
Representative Hornstein, were you? Yes.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. I was going to maybe raise this later in the discussion, but since it's on the table now, it seems to me that since we've started discussing this bill, we've really been dealing much more with employment policy than transportation policy, although this clearly belongs in this committee. I don't argue that because of the points that Representative Morrow raised. But no matter what we do with this bill, it seems to me that the appropriate it should go to the jobs, Representative Gunther's committee, prior to the floor, because there seems to be a lot of jobs policy in this bill. So again, regardless of the Senate companion or ultimately where this ends up, it seems for our process in the Minnesota House that we should probably re-refer this to the to Representative Gunther's committee.
Thank you for your comments. I'll consider that here in a moment, Representative Hornstein. Representative Gauthier, do you still have a question for the testifiers before we?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reynoso, it's not uncommon to work 12 hours a day, correct?
Absolutely
Mr.
not.
Mr. Reynoso?
Mr. Chair, no.
Mr. Gauthier. Mr. Chair. So your point about the 8 to 10 is you're losing overtime for 2 hours and then you're picking up on the 11th and 12th hour.
Mr. Reynoso?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, yes.
So that's clearly a pay cut.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just to elaborate a little bit more, is the fact is this is just it's an assault on the 8-hour day is what we feel. And the 8-hour day is an 8-hour day, and anything beyond that has always been a premium.
Okay, Representative Morrow.
Just to be clear, Mr. Chair, and I was just checking online, there is a Senate companion, and the Senate companion was introduced on the 16th, and it was referred to jobs and economic growth.
What?
So not to be picky, but I just want to make sure that we're clear, there is a Senate companion that may be moving.
Thank you for the information. I heard otherwise just a few moments ago. So, Mr. Melander, I have a question for you. Collective bargaining agreements, I know there's usually a master agreement out there, but when a project comes up, say, like on the 169-494 project, which is a design build, I believe, is it common for the unions or the trades to negotiate specific agreements to a project like that where there may be a deadline with incentive payments built in for the contractor and so on?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, on that specific project, I do not believe that there was what I'll call a site-specific agreement.
Okay, that's what they're called, site-specific agreements,
yes.
And they can't happen then?
And, no, it can, okay. But I just, in reference to that specific project, there was not a site-based specific agreement, but it can happen within the industry, not typically within the highway industry, possibly within the heavy and the construction industry, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
I just grabbed an example.
Sure.
Perhaps it was a poor one, but I was just wondering about that. May I add another question too? Oh, if the if this language was to be adopted that allowed the 10 hour 4 tens to be permissible, could it be possible? Well, I'm going to answer my own question just as I'm thinking out loud here. That if a site specific or type of contract was applied to a design build project or something that a contractor or a consortium of contractors was trying to compete for, I suppose they would be at a disadvantage to someone who made another agreement with another union. Now I'm expressing my ignorance of how far the trades reach across the projects and the different contractors, but help me out if you want to contract or comment on my convoluted question.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, you know, on-site specific agreements there are is exactly what we defined it as, site-specific conditions. They may deal with work hours. They may deal with starting times, if in fact it isn't addressed within those site agreements, if in fact individuals did have bargaining agreements, it would refer back to those local bargaining agreements.
Thank you for the input. Members, further questions for these two testifiers? Let me ask staff here, is anyone else that's still here that was going to testify, or did they have to leave? Dan McConnell, is there Dan McConnell in the audience? Dan, do you want to come down and testify as well?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Folks, I appreciate you staying. And Mr. Milan, if you have to go, thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And just for your benefit, because you know we had talked offline, I think we're going to amend our motion to send this to Jobs and Economic Development next and give a little more dwell time here for seasoning and accommodation along the way, okay?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan McConnell was not able to stay tonight, so he asked me to deliver his testimony. My name is Bill Haney. I'm legislative director for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers State Council. Mm-hmm. State Council has over 15,000 members across the state of Minnesota. Roughly a little more than half of them are electricians, building trades people. We're opposed to this bill. We're concerned about the impact it'll have on safety and other aspects of the personal life that have been really discussed today. We view this as a bargaining table issue when workers are being asked by an employer to change their working conditions, whether it's hours or which days they get off or whatever. There's a lot of other considerations that go into that, including other provisions of the contract. People are being asked to drive to a remote site long hours. There may be per diem involved for overnight accommodations so that they don't have to drive 80 miles each way to their work site. There may be accommodations made, you know, for being a great American on the 4th of July and having a real weekend to follow up. But in any case, there's also factors that go into safety with the weather, whether it's summertime and you're out there 80, 90 degrees and extreme humidity, and you got sweat running in your eyes and you're dehydrated and you're tired. That impacts your decision-making capability and your ability to drive home safely and come back to work safely the next day, just as if it's, you know, 0 degrees out in the winter and you're freezing, and that impacts your safety judgment as well. So appreciate your consideration of the bill.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. Haney, questions for the testifier? Representative Leidinger?
Mr. Haney, do people in the trade usually work 12 hours? Like Mr. Gauthier was saying, Representative Gauthier was saying that most of the time they work 12 hours.
Mr. Haney?
I mean, is that a safety? I can understand that might be a safety issue working 12 hours.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative, in some cases they do. In some cases they don't. It depends on the job and what kind of contract they have with the employer or with the contractor and what site-specific arrangements have been made, like Mr. Melander was referring to.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Haney? Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Representative Torkelson, do you have anyone else is there anyone else who would like to testify about this bill in the audience? I have my list here, and again, thank you for your forbearance in coming back this evening. Let me try that again. Any concluding comments? Thank you, Representative Morrow. Before we pass this, we're going to amend the motion to pass and send it over to Jobs and Economic Development for a little more seasoning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I as a farmer and not having much knowledge about labor law or hours and how this overtime stuff works, it just seems to me that from what little I know, that the 40 hours of regular time are something that a contractor is going to make use of in his contract to keep his costs in line. Whether he uses those 40 hours in 5 days or 4 days, he's going to use those 40 hours of regular time. And those that are in a job where they're going to be working overtime anyway, they're going to get paid for their overtime. I don't see how we can figure this as a cut in wages. This allows some flexibility for contractors to bid competitively and use their workers wisely and not abuse them. So with that, I will look forward to the renewed motion.
Further questions or comments for Representative Torkelson before we do an amended motion? Members, Representative Vogel amends his motion that House File 1032 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Jobs and Economic Development Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Nay. The motion prevails. The bill is re-referred to Jobs and Economic Development. Thank you, members. And to the gentlemen and ladies in the audience, we're looking forward to your continued chatting about this and season this a little more, and we'll look forward to a good visit in Jobs Committee. I'm going to turn the gavel over to the Vice Chair, Representative Murdoch, and we're going to have a couple of railroad bills come up now.
He's working on the railroad.
You were voting on the
Mr. Chairman, let's take House File 1348. Well, let me see just a moment here. Do you have anything going on tonight? Dave, are you good to wait for another? Okay. All right. Free as a lark. Okay, good deal. Let's do House File 1348. Mr. Chairman, I'd recommend it pass and be referred to the General Register and held over for possible inclusion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, it's your committee, so.
Thank you. Well, you're in charge at the moment. Right. Members, this bill came up a couple of years ago. It appears that some of the communities around the state have discovered, since we've authorized storm water maintenance or utility funds, that railroads are attempting target as they run through town with long stretches of right-of-way and so on, to start assessing them stormwater charges. The bill basically exempts the railroad track and its right-of-way switching yards, bridges, and trestles. I should point out that in looking through the bill, and as per my request of the railroads, it does not include like office buildings, parking lots, shops, and warehouses and other things where there actually is impermeable surface that looks like very much like an industrial park. Those would continue to be assessed. This would just be the right-of-way for the track. Many times that right-of-way, that track, actually predates the towns that are being served and assessed by the community. And in many times, the drainage through those towns actually was originally built by the railroad companies. Now, a little while ago, I actually did have a testifier. Oh, here he is, Representative Mr. Apitz. Excuse me, members. Mr. Apitz had a couple of our railroad friends here. I don't know if they could stay, but Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd like to introduce my testifier on this bill.
Okay, Mr. Apitz, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and tell us your story.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Apitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and we represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. I'm here on behalf of the vice president of the association, Mark Wagner, who was one of the people who put this bill together originally. And he had to excuse himself to take his daughter to a function this evening. So his apologies, and I'll try to do my best, because he has firsthand experience with this. And I will try to be very short, because the last time I was up here, I just about passed the bill that I was opposed to. So I might just say a distinction that needs to be made in this bill, and I'll go back to what the chairman said, was that we're talking about operating property. That's property which the railroad operates on, and it's distinguished in the bill as right-of-way, switching yards, bridges, trestles, and track. We are not talking about buildings, parking lots, industrial sites. We're not talking about sites like that. And the distinction is between surfaces that are porous, trestles, railroad track, rights-of-way, and non-porous surfaces, parking lots and that type of thing. And the distinction here is important, because it's the non-porous runoff that is taken into the city sewer and storm sewer systems that is processed by the city. The porous stuff runs into drainage systems that we've developed over 100 years or so, and that were in fact used by cities long ago, before about 1983, when the Metropolitan Council and the legislature authorized for the Metropolitan Council stormwater sewer systems to be developed. So I draw that distinction because what's happening essentially is a number of communities have begun to assess railroad property which runs through their towns for systems that typically we don't use. As a matter of fact, systems we haven't used in a long, long time. You say to yourself, well, where does the runoff from the railroad go? It goes down ditches that we've developed along the right-of-way, along the trestles, into holding areas and into wetlands, other areas like that, that purify and take the pollutants out of the water. So essentially what I'd like to say is railroads are happy to pay for what they use, but what they don't use, they would prefer not to be charged for, and that's what this bill essentially does.
Mr. Chairman, it's that simple. We're happy to stand for questions unless there's anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking of the I get what you're saying about the line going through a town,
mm-hmm.
But I'm also thinking of the switching yards at Pierce Butler. Pretty major area.
Big switching yard.
And what I don't see, I was kind of looking through here, whether we have a fiscal note on this and whether anybody has looked at the local fiscal impact. I mean, normally we designate whether there is a local fiscal impact, but I don't see a fiscal note. Maybe the author knows whether something's been done.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Houseman, when we did this bill 2 years ago, there was no impact to the state. There could be to local municipalities and so on, but generally, and I'm looking at Ms. Zewers, we don't require fiscal notes if it has no state impact, although it may intrigue us to know what that number is. Mr. Chairman, perhaps we could ask staff to comment on the impact or necessity of a fiscal note on this particular bill.
Certainly. Ms. Zewers.
Mr. Chair and members, a fiscal note hasn't been requested on this bill, and a local impact note has not been requested either. That would be the means for gathering the local impact on this, and that would be done through Minnesota Management and Budget.
And maybe then to Mr. Abbott's, I heard your message about the track going through the town, but when I know the scope of the switching yards at Pierce Butler, I just, you know, it's not quite as neat and clean as a track through a town. Do you have any observation about the switching yards and their impact?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Houseman, I don't know specifically, to be candid with you, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what each of the towns charge. I know along the TCW, the charges that they've incurred are like Eden Prairie's charging $3,000 for the track that goes through that particular area. They also run through Bloomington, a little piece of Bloomington, and that's about $200. The way it's calculated is they take the amount of porous, they take the size of the area that we're talking about. In a railroad or a switching yard, it's kind of long and narrow. They take the amount of square feet there. They take the type of surface that it is, the type of porous surface that it is. So if it's a golf course, it's one thing. If it's a parking lot, it's another thing. And that's one of the problems here. It's kind of hard to tell from time to time what it's going to be categorized as. Chan Hassen categorizes us like a golf course, actually like a street, which doesn't get assessed. And then you take it times a rate that's established, and you get your fee. So to tell you specifically what impact this would have on local communities, you'd have to kind of assess all the local communities. But I do know there's a couple of local communities who are right behind me who could maybe answer the question better than I could, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Right behind me who could maybe answer the question better than I could, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Appitz. We have a couple more questions and some testifiers back there. Should we finish the questions first?
Why don't we do the testifying?
Do the testifying? Okay. We have Jan Finn and...
They may actually answer some of the questions, so we can...
Okay. Ms. Finn and Pierre Ouellette.
Very good. You got it right, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Good afternoon, and welcome to the committee. So, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, here to respectfully oppose House File 1348. Just in the way of a very brief background, under state and federal law, cities are required to manage stormwater to comply with federal mandates and state mandates. And as many as 200 cities, we believe, have implemented stormwater utility fee schedules on all properties within their communities, including tax-exempt and federal government properties and other unit of government properties, to pay a share of the cost of complying with this mandate. As Mr. Ouellette will tell you, the formula for calculating how much each kind of land use pays is carefully and thoughtfully calculated at the local level. What this bill, we believe, does is it means that there will be tax increases to other property owners within a city and probably a local fiscal impact to the point that Representative Hausman made. At a time when we're trying to keep taxes down, we don't think it makes sense to give relief to a profitable industry at the expense of other residents and businesses. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Finn. Mr. Ouellette?
Hi, Pierre Ouellette from the City of Minneapolis. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this. We want to add our voice in opposition to this bill, at least as it's currently drafted. It's really bad timing in that the cities are being asked to do more and more by the MPCA and by the federal government to deal with stormwater. It's quite an emerging issue for local governments, and we need to be able to raise funds in order to do the kind of things that we're being asked to do and will be asked to do more and more, especially as the TMDL process comes forward for a lot of water bodies, and we have to deal with the rainwater putting in them. About 5 years ago, Representative Hornstein, and with the support of Representative Biskins, helped us create our ability to do our stormwater utility. And it was we took kind of an ambitious charge at it. We didn't just measure every single parcel size and charge for it. We actually measured each parcel in terms of its impervious surface. So every parcel was looked at and was given a value of how much impervious surface, so that the places where it was impervious, you didn't get charged for it. For instance, like a large piece of property, like a rail yard, may not have a lot of impervious surface and therefore may not pay quite so much in terms of their size. Now, a small property like my house is all driveway, house, and garage. I have almost no impervious surface on my property, and I pay a higher value because of it. We create an appeals process so every single property can be brought forward if you don't agree with what you're paying on your stormwater utility, or you believe that you have more impervious surface, then the city will negotiate how much the property is charged for stormwater. And probably most importantly, we provide very deep discounts to any property that can show us that they can deal with their stormwater on site by creating holding ponds, rain gardens, and other swales that allow the rainwater to stay in place and therefore not tax the infrastructure that those fees are paying for. But in Minneapolis, everybody pays. Churches pay, nonprofits pay, the counties pay, the railroads pay now, currently, and have been, and even the federal properties pay, as well as MnDOT. But they pay at a level that's consistent with their effect on the stormwater infrastructure system, and that's what the fees are for. Just so a side note, we don't charge the railroads for most of their straight-line right-of-ways. Our biggest concern is in the yards and the storage areas in which the train cars are put. Those are the properties that we charge for stormwater, and the railroads have been paying ever since. With that, I guess I'll stand for questions.
Okay, thank you. First up is Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this kind of tees up the question I was going to ask. So this will have a tax impact on local communities. They currently charge this stormwater fee. Am I going to correct, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ouellette or Ms. Finn?
Mr. Ouellette?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct. I mean, you have a stormwater. Most cities have what is called a stormwater program, which is their capital program to deal with their stormwater based on the estimates of what they need to do to deal with it. If you remove a piece of property that is no longer paying into that system or no longer paying any rates, the other properties will likely have to pay more in order to make up for the amount of money needed to pay for the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Beard, has this bill been heard in taxes, or is it intended on going to taxes? I don't know if Mr. Representative Runbeck or Chair Runbeck would want to see it in local property taxes. I think because it's going to have an effect there.
Representative Beard, do you have a preference as where
Mr. Chair, no. The chair of that local property taxes has not asked for it, and I haven't asked for it to go there because it was an exemption from a utility fee that this legislature enabled a few years ago. And I suppose that'd be a good question for staff, is how long have they been collecting stormwater utility fees? Because I know it is an invention that's a little more recent than property taxes, that's for sure. But I'm sorry, I don't have the floor yet. I think Representative Nelson did.
Well,
so my long answer to his short question was no, I haven't asked for it, and they haven't asked for it either. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, and I guess former Representative Dorman couched me well when I was a freshman that a fee is a tax, and a tax is a fee, and they're all revenue that's for the state. And so I would think, at least I would think, that this should go to taxes, either regular to the general taxes or the local government division, just to make sure that they know what's going on so that they can see, because it does affect, it does have taxes right in the bill, and it talks about taxes. So I guess that's just a comment.
Okay, next question we have is Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and this could either go to our friends from the League of Cities in Minneapolis or Mr. Apitz, but is there any precedent for another carve-out, if you will, exemption from this from the stormwater fee from another industry or interest?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortz, I don't think so. I haven't researched it that far, but I don't think so. And again, to the question of fee or tax, the railroads aren't sitting here saying we're not willing to pay the fee for what we use, for the system that we use. It's the assessment for what we don't use that is of consequence. And just to back up real quickly, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, originally we were the sanitary sewer system for the cities. When the railroads were built, going back many, many years ago, and I won't go into depth on this, but the last thing that a railroad wants is water. Water is the biggest enemy of any sort of railroad that you've got. So we have very well-engineered systems that draw that water away. The towns were built around the railroads, and oftentimes the sewer ran into the railroads and off into wherever it would go. In 1983, the legislature and the EPA and others decided that we should have sanitary sewer systems that were set up specifically for drawing water away from the non-pervious surfaces of the cities that they were that these systems were set up in. And it was after that that we began, that the water was drawn away from us, but we were assessed for various of these, for the track that runs through town, the switching yards, and other particular items like that. We're saying don't put the fee on us. We're not saying we're unwilling to pay a fee for what, for the pervious, the non-pervious surface that we have. It's the pervious surface that I'm talking about here. That was a long answer, and I apologize, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Merle.
Stormwater, not sanitary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm still trying to work my way through this a little bit then. And Mr. Apitz, I think actually it was something you just said. I want to be clear on this bill. And Representative Beard, I know there are only two chairs up there at the moment, but I'm reading lines, first reading lines 110 and 111, exempt from a levy special assessment charge for stormwater and for stormwater handling systems. And I think maybe, Mr. Apitz, the question first for you, do I hear you correctly when you said you do think the railroad should be charged for some aspect, for the impervious surfaces, but not the pervious surfaces?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mr. Apitz.
Morrow, that's correct. Okay. Yes, certainly. Okay. If it's a building that we have, an office building, if it's a parking lot associated with the office building, if we lease the facility to somebody else, certainly.
Mr.
Chairman, Representative Beard, I'm just looking at line 1.19 where it references section 444.20 taxes, and I just would maybe echo Representative Nelson's point about whether this should or should not go to the local property tax or to the taxes committee. And then I have a question for Mr. Ouellette, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
You mentioned, Mr. Ouellette, about everyone in Minneapolis gets charged, pervious or impervious, and that the amounts differ, I think, based on the nature of the property itself. So, for example, the city of Minneapolis is charging churches, I imagine, for stormwater and for stormwater handling systems. Am I right about that?
Mr. Lett?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Willis, so let's suppose I just had an empty spot. Maybe they could build a stadium on it someday, but I had an empty spot, nothing on it at all in Minneapolis. Would I be charged a storm water or storm sewer or storm water handling system fee?
Ms. Verlet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, you would, depending on how much, unless you could prove that none of the water left the site and it didn't use any of the local infrastructure. If there's no effect on the local infrastructure, which frankly is pretty unlikely given sometimes the rain events that we do have, even the most impervious, pervious surfaces still sometimes have runoff from them and have to rely on storm water infrastructure in order to properly drain them.
And Representative Morrow.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but I really am trying to understand this. So, for example, Mr. Wood, I've got communities where there are farms, right, on the border of town. Do you know whether farms are being charged for stormwater or storm sewer fees?
Mr. Lett.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, I don't believe there are any farms anymore in Minneapolis, sure. So I can't really speak to that.
And it may be Ms. Finn who actually might know about that. I'm just trying to imagine there are properties out there that don't have runoff into any stormwater system. And why we would then be charging them to pay for the stormwater system, other than we're trying to spread the cost of this public benefit to everybody in the public subdivision.
Ms. Verlet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, there are cases where properties have proven to the city that they are able to fully handle their stormwater on their own. It's just a couple. They've taken great steps to create large swales or stormwater ponds or other things, so they don't pay very, they pay very, very little, almost nothing.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was the thing that I thought I had remembered you saying, too. You are property specific, and you said you do take a look at the impact, and then you do provide deep discounts in some cases, I think was the phrase you used. And that would allow you, for example, to look at a switching yard and say, what are the issues there? And are there some reasons that that's different? My question, I guess, for both of the local government people, this is something that I've just never asked before, but I know every time we see a fiscal note, it has a line for local impact, but we don't get that unless someone requests a state fiscal note. But you indicated, Ms. Zewers, that we can request a local impact. I just wonder who does that. Is that something the local governments, as you track bills, can that request come from you, direct to MMB, for a local impact of?
I believe Ms. Zewers has the answer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, requests for local impact notes, I believe, typically go through either the chair of the taxes committee or the ranking minority member on that committee, or the chair of the Ways and Means Committee or the ranking minority member on that committee. Those requests go to Minnesota Management and Budget, and then they typically survey local units of government and collect the data and then submit that back to the legislature.
Members, any more questions for the testifiers or Chair Beard?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I've got just a few concluding remarks. I think that in listening to this excellent testimony, the suggestion that this be re-referred to local property tax division is one that certainly makes some sense. I know that when the bill was originally carried, if you'll remember a couple years ago, it was for the short lines and the regionals in particular because they moved more through greater Minnesota and not so much through the urban area. Because one of the things we never envisioned was something that Representative Hausman raised, for instance, Pierce Butler route, where the piggyback yard is. There's a lot of impervious surface there, and I certainly would expect that they would be paying a stormwater fee. However, I think some of the newer yards that have been built, the stormwater is pretty much contained and treated on site. And so by rights, and if everyone's treating everyone like Minneapolis does, apparently, there wouldn't be much of an impact. However, the stories I'm hearing anecdotally, and I'm sorry that our friend from the regional railroad couldn't be here this evening, is that there are a lot of cities around the state that are not treating them with that kind of consideration, and it's certainly something that I think we may want to move ahead and work on a little bit. So, Mr. Chairman, unless there's any other questions, I'd like to amend my motion that the bill be recommended to pass and be referred to the local property tax committee, whatever the official name is of that committee, but before we do, I think I might see another question.
Another question from here. Representative Nelson.
Is the local property taxes a division, or is that a separate committee? I'm not on it, so I don't know.
I believe that's a division.
So I believe then the proper motion would be to send it to taxes, then taxes would send it down to the division. That's how it has worked in the past. So I guess the motion probably should be send it to taxes.
That works for me, Mr. Chair, but I know that we're not doing quite as many deflections from
and I don't know,
as it had been, but boy, who can straighten us out so we send it to the right place?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Burris, not you? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do believe Representative Nelson's right. The proper motion would be to refer it to taxes.
Worked for me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, then to taxes it goes. With that, Representative Beard amends his motion that House File 1348 be recommended to pass and referred to taxes. With that, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
And it's passed and off to taxes.
Thanks for your help.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Mr. Chairman, I hope
we
can end the evening on a simple little bill. It'll be fun to talk about and should be able to pass for peace in the valley. House File 1284, I'd like to recommend it pass and be referred to the General Register, and we may include it in the omnibus bill as well. And Mr. Chairman, if I may, I've got Mr. Dave Brown from the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers to speak to the bill this evening. Dave, do you have anyone else you'd like to talk to us as well? We have questions. However, Mr. Chairman, I've got the bill introduced, but I believe you have in your packet a DE amendment.
Yes, we do.
And I'd like to move the DE amendment to put the bill in the shape in which I'd like it to be for discussion. But on the so what do we have, a motion, an amendment? I can do one more. Mr. Qualley has recommended or asked that I make an oral amendment on page 2 of the DE amendment, 2.32. You'll see there's the words assistant engineer, which apparently in Minnesota there is no such position.
That's on right.
That is correct. That's correct.
There's locomotive engineers, there's conductors, there's other members of the crew, but in Minnesota we do not have assistant engineers. Apparently that's unique to Montana. So if you'd strike those words, the DE amendment will be in the position I'd like it to be so that we can pass the DE amendment.
Okay. You just want to incorporate that?
I'll incorporate it.
Perfect. Yes. Okay. Members, any discussion to the DE1? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. And the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, members and Mr. Chairman. The train operator exemptions refers to the state patrol their automatic reflex, I guess, when they come upon a scene of an incident, particularly at a grade crossing or something like that, of just asking everybody for their driver's license. I remember years ago when I was an assistant engineer, actually, fireman we called him colloquially, for the Penn Central Railroad, and we hit a coal truck one day on a rural road crossing, and there was injury to the driver. He actually would have been fine had he stayed with his truck, but he panicked and jumped and broke his leg. So, of course, the cop showed up, and the officer came up in the cab locomotive, didn't know what to do, so he asked us for our driver's license. And I remember our old engineer said, words to the effect of, heck no, you're not going to get our driver's license. And a little dust-up ensued, and after a while, the cooler heads prevailed, and we showed him our driver's license to prove that we were actually real people and all that. But nonetheless, the point of the discussion is train employees on trains in the United States are actually certified by the federal government and actually have federal certification to operate the equipment on which they are working. So that it seems appropriate that when something happens on a railroad, which is private property, and interacts with any situation where somebody else might be involved, where the police have to be called for a police report, that the federal identification is actually what would be asked for so they can prove their certification and their ability to be there. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Dave Brown from the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, a union that I did not belong to. I was a UTU guy, but I'm sure that Mr. Brown will do a fine job explaining the rest of the bill.
Well, thank you. It's Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Brown, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. David Brown, and I'm a member of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. We're also a division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Rail Conference. We're the oldest union in the United States until 2003. We were created back in 1863. I'm here today representing the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen as a state chairman of the legislative board. I'm here to request your support of this bill that would create an exemption for having to produce and have a driver's license, a Minnesota driver's license. There have been incidents of railroad workers in the state of Minnesota that and the surrounding states that are involved in crossing incidents that upon producing and having their driver's license information placed in a state's database via a accident report were consequently subject to the railroad worker's own personal auto insurance screening. Through these screenings, the insurance carriers have increased premiums on these members. And only after extensive protests has those premiums been reduced. But unfortunately, like with most increases, you pay the increase first, and then they figure out the rest later. And then you end up getting a credit later on. And in these trying times, that's very costly for the people. Plus, it creates a hardship for their families. I could go into more details, but I know the members have had a long day, and there is a story that of an individual that this actually happened to after a death on a crossing incident. But to forego that, rail carriers operating into and within the border of the state of Minnesota require railroad employees to maintain and have in their possession a company-issued photo identification card. Locomotive engineers are required by federal law to maintain and have in their possession a federally licensed engineer certification. Most railroaders in this state, because of the water ports, dry and water that are in this state, are required to maintain and possess the transportation worker identification credential. We have many forms of ID on the railroad. This would clarify those issues for law enforcement that the railroad workers being held to the high standards of the Federal Railroad transportation laws and the stringent requirements of rules and policies of the rail carriers themselves and the state of Minnesota that the citizens of Minnesota and this nation demand. And we're more than happy to live up to those standards. The BNS, the BLET Trust sets the clarification of restricting the issuing of traffic citations to the railroad worker to resolve any conflicts associated with state and federal laws. Railroad workers have and carry a carrier required photo proof identification, federal licensing, certification, credentials that clearly states the identity of a railroad worker in the event of a rail crossing incident. I encourage this committee's support of this bill that addresses this critical issue that impacts railroad workers and their families. Mr. Chairman and esteemed members of the committee, on behalf of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen and the Teamsters Rail Conference, I thank you for your consideration of my comments. And I'm pleased to answer any questions, concerns, or clarification requests at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Members, any questions for Mr. Brown? Seeing none, thank you very much. Do we have any other testifiers in the audience, pro or con? Boy, that is a simple bill, Chair Beard. We just jinxed it, didn't we? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to renew my motion that if the bill passed, be referred to the General Register.
As amended.
As amended. As amended. Thank you. Yes.
As amended. Thank you, Mr. Nisley. Members, all in favor?
Say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? All right. Passed. And with that, we'll be adjourned.
Adjourned until Wednesday, 12:30.
Wednesday in the basement.
Basement.
Correct. All right. We are adjourned.